You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the April 11th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. I don't know if it has occurred to any of you, as it has to me, that allowing John Bolton to enter the White House as President Trump's national security advisor, as he did on Monday, may be akin to Nicholas Cruz being welcomed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, with a loaded AR-15, despite the local sheriff and the FBI having been warned a number of times that the young man was armed, dangerous, and threatening to kill. Like Cruz, Bolton is given fair warning of his plans in the mainstream media. An enthusiastic promoter of the war in Iraq, still considering it to have been the right thing for the U.S. to have done, he has written op-eds for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and told listeners to Fox News a number of occasions, where he has been a regular fixture, that the U.S. should bomb both North Korea and Iran, regardless of the consequences. While this has endeared him to the ultra-hawks and to Israel and to mega-donor Sheldon Adelson in particular, it has frightened the more level-headed members of both the Democrat and Republican parties who fear he will push the U.S. into another and more devastating war. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to examine the background of Mr. Bolton when I speak once again with award-winning investigative reporter Gareth Porter about his recent article in the American Conservative titled "The Untold Story of John Bolton's Campaign for War with Iran." Everybody knows Bolton's a hawk, is how Porter introduces his article, less known is how he labored in secret to drive Washington and Tehran apart. That's what we'll be discussing at 20 minutes past the hour, along with the latest developments in the apparent U.S. plan to punish Iran and Syria for an alleged chlorine gas attack, so stay tuned. The Syrian war, like the election of Donald Trump, seems to have turned everything on its head, with the terms left and right and dove and hawk having become meaningless. Thus, we see Tucker Carlson on Fox News Monday being legitimately skeptical over whether Syria did indeed carry out the latest alleged chlorine gas attack on Douma, a suburb of Damascus, while Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept, speaking from Brazil on Democracy Now!, accepts as a fact that it did. Carlson pointed out that this past February 2nd, in an Associated Press story that got very little media exposure, Defense Secretary James Mattis admitted that the U.S. was unable to prove that the widely reported sarin gas attack last April on another opposition-held area in Syria was carried out by the Assad government or even involved sarin gas. Said Mattis 2 months ago, quote, "The U.S. has no evidence to confirm reports from aid groups and others that the Syrian government has used the deadly chemical sarin on its citizens," according to the AP story. "We have other reports in the battlefield from people who claim it's been used," Mattis told reporters at the Pentagon. "We do not have evidence of it," end quote. Mattis was not ruling out the possibility that it was sarin gas delivered by Syria, just that he had not seen any proof of it. That didn't stop Trump, however, from having the U.S. Navy launch 59 cruise missiles at the cost to taxpayers of $1 million each at the Syrian air base from which the bombs allegedly containing the sarin had supposedly been fired. Mattis's admission did, for what it's worth, bolster the argument advanced by a number of international experts who disagree with the original sarin gas attribution. None, however, were given the time of day by any U.S. media to present their case to the American public. At the end of his Monday commentary, which you can find on YouTube, Carlson began an interview with Republican Senator Roger Swicker of Mississippi by asking the senator to explain why responding militarily to the allegations of a chlorine gas attack and risking a wider war in Syria was in America's national interest. "Well, if you care about Israel," the senator began, but Carlson wasn't buying it. But you can judge from Swicker's reply, who is pushing the U.S. into another Middle East war for Israel's benefit? The war in Syria has been one of competing propaganda from the beginning. Early on, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an unabashedly pro-Israel think tank launched by AIPAC in 1985, immediately adopted members of Syrian opposition groups and brought them to Washington to speak at seminars and meet members of Congress. In addition, it launched the FICRA Forum, which the latter's Facebook page described as, quote, an online community that aims to generate ideas to support Arab Democrats in their struggle with authoritarians and extremists. At the time of dramatic changes across the region, it notes, FICRA Forum is the first near real-time, fully translated Arabic-English blog to provide a two-way platform for those in the region seeking to shape the future of their countries and U.S.-based decision-makers and opinion leaders who are trying to understand and support those efforts, end quote. There is no indication on its page of its connection to the pro-Israel Washington Institute, but its connection to the events in Syria have been quite clear. A critical point raised by Tucker Carlson and other skeptics that the Syrian government was behind the latest attack was its timing. Carlson pointed out that the alleged sarin attack 2 years ago that General Mattis's February revelation had undercut, and which led to the U.S. cruise missile barrage, occurred just after the U.S. had acknowledged that Bashar Assad was likely to remain as Syria's head of state. At that point, Carlson pointed out, with Syria clearly winning the war with Russian assistance, what reason would Assad have had for launching such an attack, one that was sure to result in worldwide condemnation? In the latest instance, it came just after the president announced he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. To no one's surprise, this was openly objected to by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as well as the usual array of hawks in Washington. Now, obviously, the troop withdrawal is not only not going to happen, we may be on the threshold of a new war depending on Washington's actions. But this is clearly what neither Syria nor its allies Russia and Iran would want. So there is every reason to suspect this is the latest attack has been a false flag operation, and if there was actually chlorine gas involved, it could have been supplied by an opposition group during a conventional attack, since opposition groups have demonstrated not only the ability to obtain or produce certain conventional weapons, but chemical weapons as well. Then there are competing videos. When the Syrian army retook East Ghouta, videos taken at the time, which you can still see online, showed the streets filled with people clearly celebrating amidst the scenes of destruction, some speaking about how they had been held hostage by the opposition groups that had forbidden them from leaving. Those videos, however, you did not see in any U.S. network news. Instead, we saw photos of empty buses lined up to take opposition fighters and their families to Idlib, and now civilian victims of what we were told was a chlorine gas attack. Most are children laid out on the floor, apparently dead, with obviously shocked civilians looking on. None appear to be acting in a horrible war that has no end. Who is responsible for their deaths is a question that remains to be answered. By an extraordinary coincidence, the latest events in Syria follow on the heels of a triumphal visit to the United States by a man who more than qualifies as a war criminal, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and future king of Saudi Arabia. With the invaluable assistance of the United States Air Force, begun under President Obama, bin Salman has been responsible for launching an unprovoked war against neighboring Yemen that has led to an extraordinary famine, killed tens of thousands of its people, and produced the worst epidemic of cholera in modern times. This seems to be of no concern to either party in Washington, as a Senate with 10 Democrats joining Republicans recently voted against even having a vote on ending the U.S. role in the war on Yemen, as noted by my last week's guest, Major Danny Sherson. Bin Salman, or MBS as he's referred to, made the cover of Time and is featured in a lengthy profile in the April 16th issue now on the newsstands, along with photos and miniature of him meeting with James Mattis, Christine Lagarde, Michael Bloomberg, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Branson. By the time he departs, Time's Carl Vick writes, he will have visited 5 states plus the District of Columbia, 4 presidents, 5 newspapers, unaccounted moguls, and Oprah. American hypocrisy been so shamelessly displayed. The reader must go well into the article before even arriving at the war on Yemen. Quote, in the name of standing up to Iran, Carl Vick writes, bin Salman launched a 2015 air war in Yemen that has cost more than 10,000 lives and devastated what was already the poorest country in the Arab world. Of the 16,749 bombing runs recorded since 2015 by the Yemen Data Project, an independent human rights monitoring group, nearly a third targeted non-military sites. The UN calls it, quote, the worst man-made humanitarian disaster of our time, end quote. I should note that journalists and other outside observers have said the figure of 10,000 dead, which never seems to change, is much higher. But unlike in Syria, the world and our politicians aren't paying attention. And as it was with the U.S. war in Iraq, there is no official tally of the dead. Their numbers do not include Saudis. Bin Salman told Time, while he does not rule out sending ground troops, his priority is that the war remain painless for his countrymen. Quote, we want to be assured that whatever happens, the Saudi people shouldn't feel it, he says. The economy shouldn't be harmed or even feel it. So we are trying to be sure we are far away from whatever escalation happens, end quote. The White House so far, notes Time's Carl Vick, is happy to play a supporting role in the Yemen war, providing intelligence, mid-air refueling, and billions of dollars in munitions. To illustrate the point, the last page of the seven-page article shows President Trump sitting with a grinning Ben Salman in the Oval Office, holding a large chart with photos of all the weapon systems the United States has sold to the Saudis that have enriched our arms manufacturers while enabling the monarchy to carry out a genocidal war on the people of Yemen. Across the top of the chart is a headline all in caps reading, $12.5 billion in finalized sales to Saudi Arabia, quote. Were there an honest caption underneath, it would cite Dr. Martin Luther King, as I and others did last week, who 50 years ago described the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and he might have added, there is no close second. By coincidence, the last time I spoke with Gareth Porter, my guest who will be on the air in a few minutes, the subject was the Russian anti-Russian hysteria that has permeated the liberal media and the statements of traditional anti-war Democrats in Congress who had bought into the still unproven allegations that Russians hacked the Democrats' emails. That day I traced it back to the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine in 2014, the evidence being a talk by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland to a Ukrainian-American association in which she boasted that the U.S. had spent $5 billion on regime change in Ukraine, and a secretly recorded conversation between Nuland and the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine to which she decided who would be the country's next post-coup leader. I played both of these twice on Takes on the World. The latest fiasco seems to be the unproven allegation that Vladimir Putin personally ordered the assassination of a former Russian double agent and his daughter living in the British village of Salisbury, employing a deadly nerve gas agent. The alleged nerve gas agent, Novichok, they call it, which reportedly had been developed in the Soviet Union before its dissolution, but not produced, a key distinction, was supposed to have been applied to a doorknob at the former spy Viktor Skripal and his daughter Lyulya, as well as a local policeman had touched, and was so deadly, the public was told, that both father and daughter would not survive. Fortunately, it hasn't turned out that way. The daughter, Yulia, 33, has been released from the hospital, and her father, Sergei, 66, is making, quote, good progress and will be released from the hospital in due course. The policeman who also reportedly touched the doorknob was released from the hospital 3 weeks ago. Though the Tory Prime Minister Theresa May was quick to point an accusing finger directly at Putin and Britain's version of Donald Trump, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson claimed and still claims without a shred of evidence that the Russians have been working on this deadly nerve agent for a decade, Porton Down, British Intelligence Science Laboratory, however said it was unable to determine the source of the agent, a not insignificant admission that the British government had discounted and the U.S. media ignored. On April 3rd, The Guardian reported, quote, British scientists at the Porton Down Defense Research Laboratory have not established that the nerve agent used to poison Sergei and Yulia Skripal was made in Russia. Gary Aikenhead, The chief executive of the government's Defense Science and Technology Laboratory said the poison had been identified as a military-grade Novichok agent, which could probably be deployed only by a nation state. That's probably, not certainly. Large areas of central Salisbury have been cordoned off by police following the discovery of the cripple's ill on a park bench. Traces of NERS agent were supposedly found in a pub and restaurant with a pair had eaten, according to The Independent, leading authorities to warn that hundreds of people may have been put at risk of some exposure. Curiously, not a single Salisbury resident turned up sick, but the incident has created the worst political crisis between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War, not a small achievement by whoever was responsible. Well, in Gaza last Friday, for the second straight week, Palestinian residents of the besieged strip continued their march of return, symbolizing their efforts to claim what was guaranteed them under UN Resolution 194, passed in 1948, the right to return to their homeland, Palestine, in which their families were dispossessed in 1948. The number of marches was considerable, though not quite matching the estimated 30,000 of the initial week, in which at least 18 Palestinians were killed by pre-positioned Israeli snipers and at least another 1,500 wounded by live fire and rubber-coated bullets. Israeli sniper fire on Friday brought the number of Palestinian dead to at least 30, despite the efforts of Gazans to make targeting of individuals by Israelis more difficult by burning tires to create a smoke screen. Thanks to the Internet, however, a new story involving an earlier Israeli shooting of a civilian in Gaza, which reveals the contempt with which Israeli soldiers in the government view Palestinian lives. On Monday, the Times of Israel reported that a video surfaced showing IDF sharpshooters this past December 22nd cheering as one of them shoots and fells a Palestinian who approached the Gaza security fence. The video, which clearly does not show the Palestinian approaching the fence, was widely shared online, apparently filmed through scope or binoculars. The soldiers can be heard discussing the shot as a sniper trains his rifle on the target, then the exploding of laughter and approval when the bullet hits the target. In the video, as the Times of Israel reports, the Palestinian was not armed and was not throwing rocks or firebombs at the security fence or Israeli troops on the other side. Israel's Education Minister Naftali Bennett and Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan defended the soldiers, claiming they were suffering from, quote, the stress of the battlefield, when in fact there was no battle and no battlefield. Yesterday, the Israeli army issued a statement saying the soldier who shot the Palestinian suspect behaved appropriately, but criticized the soldier who filmed and cheered the incident for violating military values. The army said the cameraman, who was not part of the unit serving on the border, would face disciplinary hearing and possibly criminal charges.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature the passionate voice of the PLO's ambassador to the United States, Sam Zumlot. Ambassador Zumlot spoke at a conference sponsored by the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center.
Thank you very much, Akhi Muhammad, and thank you all for coming today and attending this event. It's a testament of how much you care about the issue of Palestine, the issue of justice, and I see many friends in this room. It is an utmost honor for me personally today to be at the Jerusalem Fund. And a privilege to speak at an institution founded by the Honorable Palestinian scholars, the likes of the late Dr. Hisham Sharabi and the late Dr. Samih Farsoon, both highly respected academics, pioneers, that their work paved the way for the Palestinian-American experience by providing a framework for advancing the Palestinian human rights in the U.S. and within the U.S. civil society. For us, and this is important to say, taking this opportunity, the Jerusalem Fund is a Palestinian icon of perseverance. We are a people that know too well the price of being forcibly expelled from our homeland. Yet it is institutions like this institution that have kept us strong and together all these years. And for the director, for the board of this very important place, I take this opportunity on behalf of the people and leadership of Palestine to thank you for the many years of service and for standing firm for the rights of the Palestinian people in the United States of America. Mohammed, thank you. And give a hand, please, to the Jerusalem Fund. And I know you are much more also interested in the following President Trump's remarks recently and announcement decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and the decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. There have been ever since then several critical developments in the political sphere concerning the political process and the Palestinian-U.S. relationship, and a lot of commotion, I have to say, on what will happen next. I therefore wanted to clarify some key points where we stand at this point in time and describe what we think are the options in front of us. Because this is not just about what has happened, it is also about what should happen and what might happen in the future and our collective thinking in this arena. And I'm certain that most of you who came today would want to know more about where are we going, where do we stand today, where are we going, and how do we intend to reach that destination. What is crucial for us at this point in time is that we, no matter what is our strategy, what is our next step, we must base these steps on very rooted, clear foundations, principles, pillars, so we are not lost in our journey. It is crucial that from the very beginning we outline our commitments that should shape and inspire our strategy. And here, as we all care about Palestine and the region and want a bright future for all the people of the region, we may differ, and particularly Palestinians among ourselves, which is legitimate, we may differ on the routes, the roads, the means, the tools to how to get to our destination. But we definitely do not differ on our objectives. We are united there, on where we have to go and where we need to reach. But it is important at this point in time to call a spade a spade and diagnose the situation the way it is, not the way we wish it to be. For a doctor doesn't treat cancer by diagnosing it or pretending to be a flu. And I happen to have a flu, so bear with my voice. It's not a cancer. Of course, it is human nature to be afraid of the unknown. All of us get to be concerned about the lack of clarity, especially at these times of uncertainty. We don't like not knowing, and we don't like not having control, and we don't like to feel inadequate, all of us. But as we wise-centered beings, human beings, as responsible citizens, and as a people with a cause and a calling, we conjure hope and must. We garner our strength, especially now at this point in time. And we embark on facing head on all these hurdles by conquering our fears, first and foremost. We, as a nation, are solid in our belief that ultimately we will reach and achieve our internationally endorsed rights. We must be cautious but fearless about the future. And before I delve into those, I want to reiterate our positions. The Palestinian position, the position of the people and the leadership of Palestine. To make sure that what I say is taken with that backdrop or frame of reference, if you will. Number one, we are committed to international law. We are committed to international legitimacy. We don't do this out of a need to curry favor with anyone, but of a solid conviction in the importance of respecting and maintaining an international order. No matter how difficult and delicate that order may seem at times. And it is definitely not in its best, in its best shape as we speak now. In a world that is being and becoming ever more interconnected and interdependent, isolationism becomes a recipe for anarchy. We are the people of Palestine and the leadership of Palestine. We are for internationalism. We are for multilateralism. For us, international law, international consensus, and international resolutions means the following three key principles as far as Palestine is concerned. The first principle is that Israel's occupation that began in 1967 of Palestinian territory must end. That is included clearly in the UN Security Council resolutions 242, 338, all the way to 1 year ago, UN Security Council resolution 2334. Emphasizing all of these resolutions, emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, international law is clear cut. Clear. Second principle that we adhere on as far as the international side of the story is establishing a sovereign, independent state of Palestine on this liberated territory, including East Jerusalem, all of it, complete as the capital of the state of Palestine. This is not what we say. This is what the successive international resolutions, including the U.S., co-sponsoring and voting for them. Yes. The third principle. Resolving the issue of Palestinian refugees. More than 6 million of them today. Myself included. I was born in a refugee camp. And our president, President Abbas, included. The issue of refugee is the origin of the Palestinian cause. It's the heart of the matter. And guess what? There is also clarity in international law, international resolutions about the issue of refugees, international responsibility, and the way to resolve it. There are standards. And we are no exception. There are so many other issues, other countries that have faced issues of refugeeship, including Kosovo recently. So we also want to consider international standards when it comes to the issue of refugees. And not only we accept and recognize and adhere to international legitimacy, not only by words, but by deeds. We have done our part. By A, in 1988, declaring an independent state of Palestine on the 1967 borders. That was following international legitimacy. That was implementing international legitimacy. by recognizing in 1993 formally the State of Israel on the 1967 borders. However, we did not recognize an unidentified Israel, which since 1967 did not stop for a day expanding its illegal colonial expansion deep into the occupied territory. The question is not when will there be peace in the Middle East, but rather when international resolutions, more than 83 UN Security Council resolutions for Palestine, on the conflict, 83 UN Security Council resolutions, unimplemented. More than 700 UN General Assembly resolutions, unimplemented. The question is, when international resolutions will be implemented, then peace will prevail in the Middle East. And let us be absolutely crystal clear. The two-state solution was never for negotiations. We did not accept international resolutions to negotiate the principles of these resolutions. We accepted international resolutions for implementation of international law. It was never up for a further compromise. We would never negotiate the principle of ending occupation, or the principle of establishing a sovereign state of Palestine, or the principle of the right of return for the refugees. We were looking for mechanisms and timetables for implementation. And our acceptance of international resolutions, i.e. the two-state solution on the 1967, was never, ever a Palestinian demand. It was a Palestinian concession. If the international community says that conceding 78% of your land will deliver peace, we want to consider it. The second commitment of us, the Palestinians, after international law and international system, is our commitment to nonviolence. We believe our cause is just. Our demands are reasonable, and our time has come. Popular resistance, mass movement, is what we are adopting. And it is not a coincidence that Ahed Tamimi is now a Palestinian icon. It is not a coincidence that many of the leaders of the popular resistance, peaceful popular resistance, have been rounded in Israeli jails over the last few years. You have seen that dignified mass protest, mass prayer in Jerusalem only a few months ago, in July. Our mindset, our culture, our decision-making process is all in this arena. It is crucial that we engage in where we are best. We retain the moral high ground. And we engage the entire nation of Palestine, and mass peaceful protest does. And it is also in the nonviolence, our right and our obligation to revert to international political and legal system. It is our obligation. We have to revert to the UN Security Council, to the General Assembly, to all the international organs, all of them, political and legal. It's not a revenge. We're not joining the mafia. We're joining the UN. So our ability to resist using international mechanisms is a right and an obligation, and we will not let go of this process. Our third commitment, with all the difficulties, is to a democratic process in Palestine. To build our state institutions as well. We will not let go of us being on the ground. We won't. Our skin has been there. And we will not let go of our most important weapon, if you may, that is democracy. legitimacy of representation. People's sacred right to vote in their governments and representatives. I know, given what has happened over the last years, this sounds difficult. But difficult it is. It is not a choice for us Palestinians. It's a destiny. Difficult it is. We cannot but revert back to the people of Palestine. And I know that the reconciliation process has been slower than expected since the agreement, the recent agreement in Cairo. Sometimes national processes need time, especially when the issues discussed are big, crucial, deep. Sometimes taking time is not a bad indicator. It might be actually a good indicator. We are delving deep. And we are not rushing only for the sake of striking a deal. But for every Palestinian, we know without our unity in the political sense, we can disagree. Without our unity in the political sense, our situation would be much more difficult. There was one agreement in Cairo a couple of months ago between all the Palestinian political factions. That agreement was to convene national elections by the end of 2018, this year. Hopefully this will happen, and hopefully we will all converge towards that direction. But believe you me, with all the difficulties we face, our commitment to a democratic political system must be unwavering. We cannot face up all the challenges if we don't have the power of the people and representing the people. But then let me move very quickly to the 6th of December, 2017, and the announcement by President Trump, that sudden and unilateral announcement, which in our opinion has violated three major commitments. The first is the U.S. long-held policy. Since President Truman until the 6th of December, 2017. The U.S. policy has been very clear. It's with UN Security Council resolutions 242338. It's with the ending of occupation. It's with always considering the occupation to be illegal and the settlement building to be illegal. That was a U-turn on the long-held U.S. policy, a sudden U-turn. The second violation is of President Trump himself, his promise. Because since we started the discussion with this administration, and we were saying that it's important that you return to the long-held U.S. policy about the two-state solution, about the international contours, they would tell us that they don't want to impose anything on any party. They would tell us that they don't want to dictate. They want the two sides to decide. So you promise that, and then you start taking an issue after another. The core of the issues, the mother of all issues, Jerusalem, and later on refugees, because the attack on UNRWA has to do with the issue of refugees, rather it's not a financial transaction. And the third is not to preempt and predetermine the outcome of negotiations. And if you remember what President Trump said in Davos only last week, that Jerusalem was the most difficult issue, he said. He's right there. Jerusalem was the most difficult issue because for us, it's the sticking point. That's why it's the most difficult. For us, no state of Palestine without East Jerusalem, its capital. For us, Jerusalem is not just a city, it's our identity. It's our compass. It's our national hub. And in every sense, in the historic sense, in the religious sense, in the cultural sense, it's even our hub for services, for medical services, for education. And Jerusalem is not a city we claim. Jerusalem is a city we own. It's not a claim from above. It's a claim from below, from the ground, from the root, from the hundreds of thousands of thousands of Palestinians in Jerusalem who own every home, every shop, every church, every mosque. Well, there are four things that President Trump mentioned in Davos. The first is taking off Jerusalem, or taking Jerusalem off the table. Well, we have said this and we say it again today. President Trump has taken the table off altogether. No Palestinian will sit on that table. No Palestinian will sit on that table. And I want to see any other leader who can look us in the eye and say that they represent the people of Palestine. I want to see any Arab leader who say that they can sit on such a table. We, the Palestinian people, might not be the strongest of nations, but we know our rights, and we know the limits of diplomacy, and we know exactly when to say no. And we are the only agency that represents the cause of Palestine. You want to go and search somewhere else? Good luck. The keys to peace is with the people of Palestine and with the leadership of Palestine. No matter where else you are going to look, no matter how many plots and conspiracies you are going to employ. And the second thing that was mentioned by President Trump is that we walked away from negotiations. What negotiations? What negotiations we have walked from? Since we engaged President Trump, we have been saying we're ready. This is an opportunity. There was never an offer of negotiations. There was never an offer of a timeline of engagement. There was no plan to start with. What negotiations are we walking away from? But this is a movie we have seen many times. It's boring, actually. The Palestinians walked away from negotiations. We have been on the table for 26 years. I don't think there has been any issue that has been negotiated more than our issue. It even suffers from a syndrome of over-negotiation. Too much negotiations. We did not, Mr. President, walk away from negotiations. It is the administration that has walked away from the table. Because there will not be any other table without the key principles on it. It's the administration that took the chair and left the room altogether as a mediator. We are here. We've gone nowhere. We did leave nothing. The third thing he mentioned is that the Palestinians have been disrespectful. We have been respectful of four things. The first is our own people. And self-respect for us comes first. The Palestinian people first. And we have a vivid nation, very active nation, rooted, diverse, and it is the people of Palestine that we are answerable for. Nobody else. The second, we have respected the international consensus by refusing these terms. The third respect we have done is to the U.S. itself, to the U.S. long-held policy, and to the majority of the American people who, according to all polls, have been against the Jerusalem decision and the Jerusalem announcement. And lastly, that funding will be cut from the, you know, the U.S. funding to the Palestinian Authority, the U.S. funding to Palestine. Let me say this. U.S. funding that has been there for so many years, we appreciate every penny, every dollar. But that funding was not really a gift. That funding was part of a U.S. vision. That funding was part of a U.S. commitment. That funding was part of a U.S. interest. That funding was part of an international and U.S. obligations. It makes sense that the U.S. funds its own vision of building two states on the 1967 borders. The U.S. has invested in the infrastructure of peace for all these years. And we appreciate it. But financial pressure doesn't work, especially when it comes to people like ours. It doesn't work. It's been tried before. It didn't work, and it will not work this time. If it does anything, it adds to our sense of pride and sense of resilience, if you may, against this wave. Coercive political agendas cannot be implemented by means of political pressure or weaponizing aid, if you may. Is that a term I can use? It doesn't work. Weaponizing financial assistance doesn't work. And then after Jerusalem, the U.S. freezes funding from UNRWA. I mean, denying people's education and healthcare. I was educated at an UNRWA school. And UNRWA has really been able to turn a catastrophic situation into less catastrophic, only a little bit less catastrophic. Giving people and children like me at the time the opportunity, the platform to be educated and to lead a different future. But please go back to Netanyahu's remarks, including very recently, and you will find the actual purpose of this vicious attack on UNRWA. Netanyahu said that UNRWA perpetuates the issue of refugees. So he thinks, i.e. Netanyahu, that by dismantling UNRWA, the issue of refugees will vanish. It's a fallacy. But it does exist in Netanyahu's head, that fallacy. I have news to Netanyahu and to the Israeli government. Whether UNRWA exists or not, the rights of millions of Palestinian refugees are not linked to UNRWA. It's UNRWA that is linked to them achieving their internationally endorsed rights. That's the first news. So UNRWA is there to sustain their living until their rights are achieved. And the second, our commitment to UNRWA is firm, and the international community's commitment to UNRWA is firm. And under no circumstances, UNRWA will fail to uphold its own responsibility. I received senior representatives of UNRWA in our office only a couple of days ago, and the main statement I received is that their commitment and their mandate will be fulfilled. Okay, we are here today. So let's go back to the original statement by President Trump. In his first meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu in February, President Trump said, and I quote, "One state, two states, I am happy with whatever the two sides are happy with." He said that. And we agree with him. We agree with him. We agree with President Trump. There are only two possible solutions. He's right. Either partition, two states on the 1967 borders, not even based on the 1967 borders. That's the first option, which has been endorsed by the international community and the U.S. successive administrations. Or a one state that is egalitarian, democratic, and that gives full equal rights for all of its citizens, regardless of their color or creed or religion or language. Full equal rights in the historic land of Palestine. That's the second option. President Trump is right. We now, the people and the leadership, are with the two-state solution on the 1967 borders. We are with it for implementation, not for negotiations. We are with it because we believe it's the possible, knowing that in Israel it's a non-starter, the idea of a one-state solution. We are still with it. However, we realize that Netanyahu's government actively seeks to destroy not only the present possibility of a two-state solution on the 1967 borders, but actually the future discussion of this solution altogether. The Netanyahu government is involved in removing the tracks of the two-state solution. How else would you interpret the ruling parties, the Likud, decision only a few weeks ago to annex the West Bank? How else do we translate the Knesset passing a law not to negotiate Jerusalem unless 80 members vote, which is practically an impossibility? Oslo was passed by only 61 votes, the threshold. How else do we explain that Netanyahu has taken pride only a few months ago publicly that he's the first prime minister in Israel in 20 years to build a new settlement deep in the West Bank? So proud about it. How else do you explain what he said only 2 days ago, 2 or 3 days ago, when he went to open a new road deep in the occupied territory, deep in the West Bank? What did he say? Netanyahu said, this settler-only bypass road is part of the system of settler bypass roads that are building throughout Judea and Samaria, which is the occupied West Bank, that serves the residents, settlers of Judea and Samaria, and the residents of the State of Israel, i.e. linking the West Bank to Israel via a system of infrastructure and a system of roads. This is not a government that is rejecting the two-state solution by words. This is a government that is rejecting the two-state solution by deeds. Action. Every day. Murdering the possibility. Burying it deep in the ground. And it is not circumstantial evidence we are talking about. It's clear. It's unambiguous. And people forget just not to focus only on the Netanyahu government. People forget that the Israeli Prime Minister back then, Ishaq Shamir, came kicking and screaming to the Madrid peace conference. They didn't like it. It was only after President Bush Sr., father, threatened to withhold $10 billion that he came, i.e. Shamir, kicking and screaming. And he famously, Shamir famously said back then that, and by the way, Shamir is Netanyahu's mentor. This is something Netanyahu says. Shamir was saying, I would have conducted negotiations on autonomy for 10 years. And in the meantime, we would have reached 500,000 settlers. That was 1991. In the West Bank. He was right on the number of settlers. They even exceeded the 500,000. Much more exceeded the 500,000. They did better. They stole more land than Shamir expected. They colonized more towns than Shamir expected 25 years ago or 26 years ago. But he was wrong on the number of years. It wasn't 10 years. They left us and kept us in this process for 26 years. But with the same logic, Palestinians walk out of negotiations while they were doing the real job, the real intention. They wanted to establish a process that was lasting process, not lasting peace. They established, created a process that was actually designed to prevent the outcome. Designed to prevent the outcome. As far as we are concerned, the two-state solution and the terms of the two-state solution are clear. And I'd like to repeat this. They are not up for negotiations. They are only up for implementations. And we are ready to sit on an international table, multilateral table, where the world sits there. And this is not the exception. This is the rule. For all other conflicts, it was an international table to implement international resolutions. We were made the exception for 26 years. We were told Kosovo requires multilateralism. East Timor requires multilateralism. Internationalism. South Africa requires internationalism. Iran and the Iranian deal requires multilateralism. Except you. Only the two sides can resolve the issue. Here you go, there is one side that is clear about their intention. When President Trump said that we are fine with the two-state solution if the two sides want it, effectively, we want it. We demand it. We endorse it. Effectively, it gives the veto power to the party that is unwilling. No one can love peace more than the two sides. Said who? Think the audience in this room would love peace as much as we do. The whole idea is just to leave the two sides with this asymmetry of power in one room. So it's not a process of rights, but a process of diktats. It's not a process of right, but a process of might. We're done with that. 26 years is a generation. My generation, actually. Enough. Enough. And I say it here in the heart of Washington and in the Palestine Center. Enough. Our rights are not up for sale. Our principles are set, enshrined in international legitimacy. And in the hearts of the millions of our people, and who are not any other people. I mean, let's remember, this is a very proud nation, very rooted. Everything started there. Don't blame us for that. But we exported to you almost all prophets. The oldest human community is in Jericho. Okay, so if this is the situation for the two-state solution, the first is that the current Israeli government, all the way back to Shamir, and by the way, not to just blame the right wing in Israel, because the right wing in Israel is very clear. The Likud and now all the parties to the right of the Likud, like, you know, Israel, Beituna, and all these parties, they are very clear. They say, what is yours, what is mine? They say, what is mine, and what is yours is mine. They say it clearly, by the way. The center-left in Israel, since we started the Madrid peace process, all the way to Oslo, to the roadmap, starting from what is mine, and what is yours is negotiable. We will sit and negotiate what is yours. So this, all of Israel never took the 1967 formula as a formula for implementation, but as a formula, as a starting point for grabbing more. Unacceptable. Unacceptable for a nation that has been able to concede 78% of what is its own land for the sake of peace. It's unacceptable to consider further compromises, and it will not happen. The 1967 formula is not just a Palestinian peace agenda. It is now a national equilibrium. No one can touch it. But given that, and given the clarity of the current administration that they are not going to endorse the two-state solution clearly. And in our opinion, this dangerously plays in the hand of the Netanyahu government. Given this situation, President Trump mentioned the one state. This is interesting, really interesting and important. I wish the U.S. had mentioned this before our 1988 declaration, because that was our position, by the way, before 1988. Before we accepted international legitimacy, our platform was one democratic state. Remember? The PLO. Fine, they mention it now. One state for all of its citizens with full equal rights. Palestinians accepted the two-state solution as a concession, as we said, because of the international community, was oriented around that idea. So if this administration has ideas for a one-state solution, we are interested to hearing what they have. We are. In the end, we want full rights like everyone else. And we are impartial about how we get there. It's not just about the journey, it's about the destination. However, if one state solution envisioned is a disguised apartheid or an apartheid in disguise, in one form or another, it will be rejected. And we must save our efforts and not repeat history again. This has been tried elsewhere. And it has been tried before, and it came to a crashing defeat. Needless I say, Mandela and South Africa, needless I say, Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. It's very simple. Very simple equation. Either we all have equal rights, or none of us have. Rights are not subdivided. You cannot subdivide rights. Or selective. That's called apartheid. And we are fully human. Fully human. Right? Not three-fifths. Human. We are fully human. And today, by the way, marks the first day of the Black History Month in the U.S. So please, when you hear someone arguing like Netanyahu, we will give the Palestinians a state minus. Nothing will be minus about us. Either full sovereignty on the entire land that Israel occupied in 1967 or full equal rights in the historic land of Palestine. For every citizen. We will not accept a system that is there to privilege one group over another. We've lived that and experienced that long enough. And, you know, I know there will be interesting discussion, and I'm not going to go on, but let me try to conclude by saying this. The Israeli government is absolutely delusional if it thinks that the transactional approach to the international community, to the issue of negotiations, to the situation in the Arab world is going to take it anywhere. And they are also delusional about where the moral arc of history is bending, or they are just blocking. Prime Minister Netanyahu can speak at the Congress, but do you think he can go and speak at a university in California or Wisconsin? No. Because the arc of history always bends towards justice.
To take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
You're listening to episode 543 of Unwelcome Guests, The Corruption of Money. I'm Robin Upton. And that title is the title of a PowerPoint presentation that I made last year. And it's available online. If you'd like to download it, that will help you get the most from this week's show. Its address is altruists.com. altruists.org. That's altruists.org /AE606. That's AE for Altruistic Economics, and it's presentation number 606. So in approximately 20 minutes, I will start the radio adaptation. So if you can download it between now and then, that may help. We'll also be hearing a few words from George Lakoff, the psychologist, and prison reformer Vivian Stern on how money and the market mechanisms have distorted people's ideas of justice and morality. To get us started, this is the first half of a presentation by the great John Taylor Gatto from approximately a decade ago. This is called Beyond Money.
I've had an opportunity to meet many of you and once again to be inspired by the tremendous talent that seems locked up away from the instruments of power, from any voice in this school nightmare we have, but it's very reassuring that eventually we'll get out of this. I'd also like to give you a plug for something I read last night. There's a lady here from Canada who's the editor of just a grand magazine called Natural Life. So there's an unsolicited plug for Natural Life. And finally, I'd like to dedicate this morning's talk to a great American family who's been an inspiration to me now for 3 years and to thousands of other people around the country, Day and Pat Ferenga, who spoke here, and their kids. I think they're the best of what America's made of. So this farewell, this valedictory, will be a little bit about my mother. My mother took in stray animals, mostly homeless dogs and cats, but if a hurt bird's wing needed repair, birds also. And if a turtle was crossing the road too slowly, she made my father stop the car so she could get out and carry it to the other side of the road. When Dad objected to how many animals our household was supporting, Mother took to setting large dishes of Nabisco dog food in our backyard for the wanderers. It was an act of generosity that made our house look like a kennel and drove my father frantic, not least because he was the manager of the local National Biscuit Company, and so the supply of dog bones was endless. The other day I was reading Proverbs, a collection of advice set down by King Solomon 3,000 years ago, and I came across these words: speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Suddenly I realized what my mother had done all those years that I thought she was just feeding animals. She was speaking up for those who could not speak for themselves. And reading further into Proverbs, I found this line: happy are they who are generous to the poor. And reading those words, I realized I had part of the secret that made my mother happy. For she was happy most of the time I was growing up, in spite of having a full share of her own troubles. She was unfailingly generous, not just to outcast creatures, but to anyone who came to our door for a handout, to any neighborhood person fallen on hard times and needing help. I had a little lawn mowing business in those days. I was about 13, and I remember in particular the widow with young children, whose lawn I mowed for free because my mother asked me to. I resented that at first, but after a while, I came to love it. I suppose I read Proverbs the way most people do who pick up a Gideon Bible in a motel room. I jump about, not looking for anything in particular. So it was while randomly turning the pages at one of the 260 motels I've stayed at in the last 3 years that I found this judgment, and by implication, this warning too. There is joy for those who seek the common good. When I hear that, I remember my mother's beautiful Christmas trees that took her days of hard effort to create as she sought her family's common good. I remember her collecting kitchen grease and metal scrap for the war effort in the long-gone days of World War II for the community's common good, and her fierce defense of equity as the head of the school's PTA, her founding of a Cub Scout troop when nobody in Monongahela who was male could be persuaded to do so. I remember the joy she brought to so many undertakings of my boyhood as she pursued the common good. The London Economist announced recently that 70% of all the lawyers in the world are in the United States. We have 25 times the number of lawyers per capita that Japan does, 3.5 times the number that England does, 2.5 times the number per capita of Germany. If you add our public and private practice lawyers together, about one in every 250 Americans is a lawyer. What could the meaning of this be? 70% of all the world's lawyers. Before he died, Joseph Campbell, the myth man, took note of our enormous legal fraternity, and he called it the way Americans talk to each other, the way employees talk to their bosses and brothers talk to their sisters. Lawsuits are the way we get the other guy's attention because we have lost a normal interest in each other, lost our concern for human face-to-face justice, lost the taste for plain speaking that marks a healthy people. Looking at the great tradition of English common law, there are only two reasons to bring a legal case at all. First, that someone hasn't kept a promise, has not done what they said they would do. That gives rise to contract law. And second, that someone has encroached on another person's rights and done harm, and that gives rise to tort and criminal law. So if you're looking for a new way to mark the crisis in American society, if you're wary of hearing about teenage suicide, weary of hearing about teenage suicide, divorce, crime, violence, alienated brothers and sisters, murder, drugs, even one more time, then think on the barometer of crisis represented by 70% of the world's lawyers collecting under the American Eagle's wing. There must be a tremendous number of us breaking our promises, a tremendous number of us encroaching on rights to support such a horde of barristers. We are forgetting, I think, how to live together in families and in communities, forgetting the necessary personal duties that make families and communities in the first place, in a rush to get out from under personal responsibility, to escape. How often do you hear the cry, "Let them do it, they get paid for it"? I certainly hear that cry every day in New York City. Them can mean the police or the street sweepers or the social workers or any of the other number of occupational titles that have come into being only recently. We lived for 200 years and more in this country without police. How was that managed? These occupations signal our transition from a world of human beings who live together and care about each other to a world of institutions and hired hands, a world of agents instead of principals. What does it mean that we break promises so often that an army of lawyers can earn fine and, of course, unregent-supervised livings punishing them? What does it mean that we encroach so often on each other's rights, that an army of lawyers is needed to seek redress? How did the country survive so well its first 200 years without police or without many lawyers? When we abandon personal responsibility for the common good, which Solomon urged us not to do, what does it signify? What does it mean for your future and mine that a price tag is set on simple services that through the long history of humanity were freely exchanged and freely given, like sitting with the sick, caring for the old, even caring for one's own children, or like mowing a poor widow's lawn? If it means something frightening to you, as it does to me, then what can we do about it? At the turn of the 20th century, a profound social thinker in France named George Simmel wrote a remarkable book called The Philosophy of Money. In it, Simmel, one of the great creative theorists of this or any other century, said that money contained within itself a powerful internal contradiction, and it was built into the foundations of its abstract existence, this contradiction. It could not be gotten rid of. He said that money robs things of their innate identity and replaces that core identity with a money identity. By making everything interchangeable with money, money often cheapens things and removes their significance. Simmel said that whenever genuine personal qualities like service were offered for money, that the pricing of these things inevitably trivialized the service which had been priced. Such services tend gradually to become degraded. They're never as good as they are in the first few years they're offered, to lose distinction, just exactly as if the money itself sharply reduces the value of what is being purchased. Now, even though that was written over 90 years ago, it still has a shocking and almost crazy ring to it. But Simmel was quite serious, and generations of blue ribbon readership have found enough disturbing truth in his words to keep them available generation after generation. Simmel also said, whenever genuine personal values have to be offered for money, one finds that a loss of quality in individual life takes place. So not only does the service decline in quality, but that the life that gives and purchases that service declines in quality also. For instance, in prostitution, which is a limited kind of temporary marriage for sexual purposes and for money, the monetization of sex leads, according to Simmel, to a terrible degradation of personal value on the part of the prostitute and on the purchaser of the service. Both prostitute and client are worse for the experience, not better. The sale of compassion is in welfare work. The sale of concern, even the sale of a helping hand in many instances, leads to the same destination. At some point, pricing eats away the intangible quality of service, and the central value of what is offered is destroyed. It's a complicated idea, but one well worth musing upon. It's a subtle idea that requires not an instant rejoinder, not an opinion in response, as might be asked for in a school classroom, but a long period of reflection before you decide where you stand in regard to that.
Well, in lieu of a period of reflection, we're having a change of speaker. This is a cue to introduce an audio adaptation of the presentation I made last summer, 70 slides, on the corruption of money. Now, if you still haven't found this, you could try Googling on AE606. That's the number of the presentation. If you don't feel like opening a computer, or if you're not near the internet, doesn't matter. I'll be describing the salient features of most of the slides anyway. This is, to some extent, an attempt to synthesize a lot of what we've had on the show into one easy presentation, and it does oversimplify certain matters of necessity. This isn't a complicated look at the details, such as we heard from Bernie Sanders last week. The aim is to see what is so difficult to grasp for those of us who've grown up in a moneyed society, that it doesn't have to be this way, and that pricing things and attaching a tag to everything has a lot of deleterious effects for most people, while still being in few people's short-term selfish interests. Now, let's get started. It's a presentation in four parts. I'm going to start by going over some fundamental ideas. If you remember George Lakoff's idea of the strict father as opposed to the nurturing parent, then that's going to get us started. Then I'm going to be looking at personal corruption, how the existence of this thing which was called money, and the fact that people who are selfish are rewarded and non-selfish impulses in the money system get punished. I'm going to look at personal corruption. Then I'm going to look a level out. I'm going to look at social corruption in a society full of people with different tendencies. What does it do to society if the most selfish are systematically rewarded and the most altruistic are punished in terms of their influence in the money system? Finally, we're going to be looking at global corruption. If societies are of various kinds and some are more predatory in nature than others, then will this help us understand how global institutions such as the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the American military, will this help us understand how certain large institutions, predominantly Western-backed, have come to dominate? So what is called globalization is a building of a hierarchy with a few institutions of a certain nature at the top. Now, fundamental ideas. I'm going to look at how money works on a fundamental level. I'm going to look at the financial world view, what it means to see the world through the lens of money. I'm going to contrast Lakoff's ideas of parenthood, and we're going to have a note about psychopathy. So, this is called the corruption of money. What is corruption? It has different meanings. If a computer file is corrupt, it doesn't mean it's missing. It just means that it's missing some parts of it. It's lost its integrity. So it's not going to work the way that it should work. Corrupt people, I suggest, are also lacking integrity. They're not pursuing their own goals. They may be corrupted by something, such as money in particular, and in so doing, they're having another agenda which is working through them. Corrupt organizations, as I'm defining it, and corrupt in the sense that they don't pursue their stated goals. Now, let's look at the very basic points about money, things that is so simple and so well understood that it passes without comment. Firstly, banks define what money is, and if the banks define that what you have is acceptable, other people have to accept it, and you can swap it for stuff. So the take-home message, which you learn from about the age you want to get some sweets and mum gives you some money, is the more money you get, the more you can get of whatever you want. Now, we know every purchase has a buyer and a seller. So somebody who receives money, the winner, if you like, and somebody who has to give the money, the loser. So what's the take-home message? Life is full of winners and losers, and less for you means more for me. Now, that seems obvious in terms of money, and it is in terms of material goods, but note that it's not true in terms of software. If you use the software that I'm using, neither of us loses out, and in fact, it might be a bonus. Certainly not true in terms of love. So if your thoughts are heavily influenced by money, you go around thinking, well, life is full of winners and losers. You can project that view onto what you see. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way things have to be. And if you have money, you learn that you may wish to give it away, but the more you give away, the less you have. Now, we're going to stop there for a couple of sections of an interview. This is a rebroadcast from episode 345. With prison reformer Vivian Stern on what she calls the commodification of justice. And in the first part, She's talking about how justice, which used to be understood, required, and to which everybody should contribute, like a lot of other social goods and services, has increasingly been reinterpreted in a market framework.
The other thing you mentioned was this idea of the commodification of justice. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that?
Yes, that's also quite complicated. Certainly we're seeing in this society, and I imagine it's happening elsewhere, a transformation of people from citizens to consumers. And then a new way of looking at our public services, which is not that they are provided by all of us through our taxes for all of us, and we share them, and we try and ensure those who need them most get them, but they are much more analogous to going shopping, and people should have choice, and they should look more like the sort of things you get when you go shopping, and you should fight to get the best for yourself. In the past, there was more an idea that they were shared, and we all paid for them, and we all were part of them.
Now, we're going to get on to Georgia Lakoff in a few minutes, but suffice it to say for now that what she's just spoken about is pretty much the definition of the nurturing parent, that everybody in society needs this thing that's called justice, and everybody should be prepared to contribute to it. And this is as compared to what Lakoff calls the strict father, who needs to be tough, whose analogue is market discipline, where self-maximization is the only rational behavior, and where self-maximization means other minimization. Reflect, as she continues to speak, on where this idea came from, that for me to get justice, for me to get something good, someone else has to get punished. Someone else has to suffer something negative. Is that perhaps an echo of the internalized market process? Do people think that way because the money world works that way?
Now, when this is done to justice, it's hard to see what it is you're going to give people. You're going to try and give people safe streets and make sure their cars aren't broken into, their houses aren't broken into. But what has happened very, very noticeably in the last 10 or 15 years is to re-describe justice as something that you get when someone else has been punished for what they did to you. And that is now what the word justice means in a lot of the discourse in England, certainly in England, and I'm saying England very deliberately because Scotland is a devolved country which has a very different view of the world. But in England, there will be a lot of talk about they're entitled to justice. And this justice is not justice for all of us. Well, the just outcome might be that the person isn't punished. The just outcome might be that the person gets some health care. The just outcome might be that the person gets a lot of help from the welfare system. But when justice is reduced to an individual commodity, it is then described as a punishment inflicted on the perpetrator. And when that's happened, you've got your justice. So it's an individualization. It's seeing each person as a customer or as an individual economic unit, and you're entitled to something, and the state will give you this, and they will give you a certain amount of punishment. And it seeps into everybody's thinking, and people who have been victims of crime saying, I didn't get my justice, and I want my justice, and I felt I got justice because he got 10 years or 12 years. But of course, it's not an individual relationship. It is actually something, justice is for all of us and can't really be broken down in that way. But that has become the driver of how punishment is allocated and the driver of the discourse in the media about how cases are dealt with.
And we see this zero-sum mentality all over the place. There's a Bengali proverb that says, you can only eat so much rice. After a point, everybody will start sharing the things they've got. But, of course, that's not true with money. Whatever fraction of money you have, you can always try and get more, get people into greater and greater debt. Witness the actions of the bankers at the top of the system in last week's show. It is an addiction, and it's because scarcity and fear has driven people from satisficers to maximizers. I believe that impulse does encourage people not to be generous, not to share. That impulse promotes hoarding, and in so doing, when you say, why are you hoarding your stuff? We could use that better than you could. Then if somebody tries to defend that argument, that strengthens their conception of the discrete and separate self. Another very basic point about money, you are not allowed to create it. You're not a bank. It's their system. Money comes from satisfied employers. So you keep the boss happy, you'll get your salary, or possibly the customer. But what this teaches you is that bosses must be kept happy. As an amateur, you can't get this stuff. You can't create money. You might be able to do whatever you like. You've got to get this by keeping the boss happy or by going into business, either of which is involving the system. Now looking at the world view of economics, I said money is a one-dimensional shadow of the real world. And what do I mean by that? Whatever you care to name in terms of objects, whether it's a house, a car, a cocktail, or even elements of the natural world, like a tree, these, to the economist, are all reducible to a single dimension, how much something is worth. What's the cost of polluting a stream? Maybe negative or positive. You might have to pay, or you might get this if you own that item. But economics only sees the numbers. So any amount of myriad distinguishing qualities that these items might have are indistinguishable when you look at the economic impact. If something isn't bought and sold, it's unnoticed. So economics looks at somebody who has no money, no income, and is living, say, in New York City, not in great affluence, with somebody, say, who is living in the back of beyond, growing their own food in a gift economy, and says, well, these two people are equally poor because that neither of them has money. And in spite of attempts to modify their definition of poverty, this is still how development agencies tend to regard poverty, because they can't get a handle on things which go beyond numbers. This map shows you the worldview of the economist. This is countries sized by GDP. For radio listeners, there's three huge blobs: North America, Western Europe, Japan, and South Korea, each of which looks hugely swollen compared to the geographical map. And Africa is almost completely missing, and the rest of the world is pretty small. So if you wish to go into business, ask yourself, is it worth feeding Africa? Is it worth innovating for the third world? Well, if they don't have any money, it's not worth it by the economist's definition. So no wonder people in Africa are growing flowers and exporting them to Europe or the rest of the world, because Europe, North America, Japan and South Korea have a lot of money to pay for things which people in third world countries don't have. So if you're a profit maximizer, it doesn't make sense to try to sell to a local market which doesn't have money. Now we're going to compare two different ideas of fatherhood. This is the strict father, as exemplified by the quote, survival of the fittest, survival of only the fittest. And this idea keeps coming up in this presentation. So rather than having my potted summary, I thought, let's recall, Unwelcome Guests episode 505, what George Lakoff had to say on strict father mentality.
Conservative ideology in general, and a certain view of morality, which I'll call strict morality. It goes like this. There's a difference, by the way. It's a gendered system. Daddy is different from mommy. You got to have both. It's got to be a gendered system. Why do you need a strict father? Because there's evil out there in the world, and he's got to protect the family from evil. Because there's competition out in the world. There will always be winners and losers. He's got to be a winner to support the family. Because children are born bad in the sense that they just want to do whatever feels good. They don't know right from wrong. And you need a strict father to teach them right from wrong. So you need a strict father to teach your kids right from wrong. How do you do it? Well, Dobson says there's only one way: punishment when they do wrong, and maybe reward when they do right. It's a sort of behaviorist system. And the punishment, he says, must be painful enough so that the child will want to discipline himself or herself to do the right thing to avoid the punishment. That's the idea, to get internal discipline to avoid the external discipline. And Dobson, by the way, is one of the more liberal people on this matter. He says that you should never hit a child under the age of 15 to 18 months. There are other authors who have it earlier, like from birth. Now, if a child is disciplined, that's the only way a child becomes a moral being, through such discipline. And if the discipline occurs, there's an extra bonus. What's the bonus? The bonus is they can then pursue their self-interest to become self-reliant and prosperous. That is, there's a link between morality and prosperity. The same discipline that allows you to be moral. Morality is seen as obedience to a moral authority, God or the strict father at home. That the same discipline that allows you to be obedient to a strict father is the discipline that allows you to become prosperous. And there's a logic here. Suppose you're not prosperous, then you're not disciplined enough. And if you're not disciplined enough, don't have the discipline to be moral. So you deserve your poverty. And that has social implications. Now, another major part of this model is that after a child has grown and become mature, if they have gotten the self-discipline, they can go out in the world and take care of themselves. If they haven't, if they're still dependent and haven't been sufficiently disciplined, then they also should go out in the world. They receive, by the way, the name for this discipline is called tough love. There's a word for it. They have to go out in the world and be disciplined by the world. And if they can't make it, too bad. Okay? But by the time they're adults, that's what they should be. Now, there's another part of this. Why is it moral within this system to pursue your self-interest? And Dobson is very clear about this. This is a version of Adam Smith's view of capitalism. The idea in at least the popularized version of Adam Smith is actually a more complicated thinker than that, is that if everybody pursues their own profit, then by the invisible hand, as a law of nature, the profit of all will be maximized. So it's good to pursue your self-interest because you're helping everybody else.
So strict father will see America, because it's the richest, as the most righteous. And yes, Europe is educated, Japan, South Korea are hard-working, so those people who have money deserve money. If the third world is poor, it's because they're overpopulated, they're fundamentalist, Africans are lazy, so they deserve to be poor. Contrasting idea, the nurturing parent, and if you've got the presentation in front of you, this is the yellow smiley face as opposed to the red angry face, exemplified by the quote, "What goes around comes around." The first duty of parents is to protect their kids. Kids should learn to be responsible for other people, learn to have empathy, and society should provide for all its members according to their need. So, looking at the world through the eyes of the nurturing parent looks at North America, Europe, and Japan and says, why are these places consuming so much of the world's resources? These places are greedy. What about Africa? Very needy. Rest of the third world, also needy. They're not getting as much as they deserve. Now, psychopathy, refer to episode 90 of the Corbett Report, an excellent show called Our Leaders Are Psychopaths. If you haven't already heard of psychopathy, it's a mental deficiency. It affects about 1% of people and it causes them to lack a conscience. So just as somebody is born blind or deaf, certain people are born without a conscience. And it's actually not that easy to spot because psychopaths quickly learn to pretend they have a conscience. They don't feel guilt and they behave selfishly with no check on their behavior. They're very good at lying convincingly because there's no part of their brain tells them they shouldn't lie. They live, generally have a parasitic lifestyle, and they ruthlessly seek power over others. They're not capable of empathy and the loving relationships which the other 99% of humanity enjoy, and in their worldview it's kill or be killed. So they seek to have power over others. I'm going to make the general case in this presentation that the money system on its own terms is basically psychopathic, and that this is no accident because psychopaths control the system and they're using the system as a means to normalize their own behavior. They're trying to teach the rest of the world their set of values, behaving as seems normal to them, and whilst selfishness, lying, parasitism is understood by pretty much every culture that I know around the world to be not the way you should do things, in the money context, this is nevertheless the way that people are encouraged to behave. And money facilitates and excuses a life of parasitism. This is a quote from Frédéric Bastiat, a 19th century economist. Quote, "When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it." Unquote. So if you've ever wondered quite why there is so much adulation of the super rich, that is part of the process of glorifying those who do the most plundering. So that was the first section. Second section, having established certain broad definitions, looking at personal corruption. Now, people naturally operate on ground of a range of motives. I'm going to suggest that money encourages selfishness and psychosis. And by psychosis, I mean not seeing the world as it is. So money corrupts people's thinking, because if you focus just on money, you're ignoring other value systems. And money is a very simple system, one number, one dimension of understanding, and you want the most. Underneath a lot of complex maths, it comes down to self-maximization. And we can hear certain phrases like, "How much is he worth?" which make clear that somebody's equated to a certain amount of money. And if we hear about compensation, that's something that has come in my lifetime, universal application of money to try to balance the equation. If you like, if you break your leg because of someone else, then they pay you a certain amount of money, and you don't need to say financial compensation. Pretty much any compensation is financial compensation. So the hidden lesson here is that anything can be expressed in money terms, which, of course, is an oversimplification when we stop and think about it. And this is a picture from an advert for a company called GE Capital. Georg's Marienhütte makes the steel flow. GE Capital makes the cash flow. And we have, looks like, one industrial engineer and one bank manager looking over a forge with some obviously molten steel getting pressed into ingots or something. I mean, the advert is a very worked out image. It's putting forward a message which a lot of people have spent a lot of time crafting. So it's worth looking at adverts. I've been looking at bank adverts, trying to understand what message they're putting forward. And this is the message that I can see. If you've looked at money, you'll know that banks create money out of nothing. It's an accounting entry. They just type something into a keyboard. And this is obviously very different from how other people get money. We have to work for our money. We have to borrow it, in fact. So why are they trying to put this image forward? Well, they make the steel flow, we make the cash flow. They're making it look like there's an equivalence there. You know, it's not easy job to make steel flow. You've really got to put in a lot of effort. So they're making it look like they're putting in a lot of effort as well. And they're trying to strengthen the metaphor in people's mind that money is a resource, that it's a scarce resource. And in fact, that's completely wrong. Banks make money out of nothing and have huge advertising budgets to try and hide that fact. And in spite of all this palaver that in the UK at least has been going on about bank bonuses and are they being paid too much and so on, I haven't seen anything in commercial media about the fact that banks make money out of nothing and then charge interest on this. And is this a rather unfair way to do things? Why do they talk about flowing? Well, if something is flowing around, then it's zero sum. So if it flows from me to you, you've got it, but I haven't got it. The only reason money works like that is because it's an analog of gold coins. If we wish to work money differently, we could do so tomorrow. Designs exist for this, such as the altruistic economics model that I put forward several years ago. Here's another advert for the same company. It's a picture of a guy working on a motorbike, the new Triumph Thunderbird, engineered with passion, power, and finance from GE Capital. So it's emphasizing the same thing again. You've got a desirable-looking motorbike, and to make it, you don't just need passion and power, you need finance from GE Capital. So if you really need money, and banks are the only way you can get money, then the bank is doing the production in part. This is my favorite one of the adverts from a bank I was in a couple of years ago. It says, "It's money's turn to work hard for you." Now, that kind of assumes that you have worked hard for your money, so your money should work hard for you. That sounds fair, doesn't it? Except, what is that saying? Money is working hard for you? So that suggests money has an ability to do work. And you're thinking, well, it's getting me interest. That's what work is. Work is anything that creates money. Well, maybe the rich like to think that their money is working for them. But, of course, money can do no work. If I'm lending you my car or a tool of some kind, something that can help you work, then I'm without that for a certain period of time while you've got it, so you might think it's acceptable if I levy a charge of some kind. Whereas when the bank lends you their money, they've created it out of nothing. So they're not losing out in any shape or form. So what moral right do they have to charge you for that experience? I would say none at all, and that's why they're trying to take this idea of fairness and pervert it. You work hard for your money works hard for you. This is going to come as a surprise to any economists, if any economists are listening to the show. In 1973, and this is not an economics research, this is a sociological result that turned up, that is of course very relevant to money. In 1973, a US blood bank asked former donors whether they'd like to donate again, and half of them were asked exactly that question, would you like to donate blood again? And 93% of that half said yes. And the other half were asked, would you like to donate blood again? We will reward you $10 if you do. And what do you think was the result? 93% wanted to when asked a simple question. When offered a $10 reward, that 93 went down to 65%. I wonder why that is. I'm explaining it here by saying that money crowds out other motives. When you frame it as an economic transaction, which happens the moment money pops up. People think, $10, is it worth it? Well, I'd have to go to the blood bank, and then I'd be without blood, and that'd be a hassle. Maybe it'd be a risk. When people evaluate it in terms of how much is in it for me, then they're thinking selfishly, and that is the natural response to introducing money into the framing. Those who are not thinking about it in those terms ask themselves, do I believe in the concept of donating blood? Is it nice to think that if I needed blood, there would be blood for me? Am I going to lead by example? So when money is involved, people behave more selfishly. This is a big problem for almost everywhere in the modern world, especially, of course, in the so-called developed countries, the most monetized countries, and we are seeing the result in terms of huge increases in depression. In spite of material affluence, there is what you might consider a spiritual poverty that abounds wherever money is very prominent in society, because people frame things in selfish terms and they end up fighting one another for money. This is, of course, nothing new from the Gospel of Matthew. No man can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. If you follow money, then you will do whatever pays the most. And, of course, that is going to subvert whatever you believe in. People don't generally pay you lots of money for doing things you were doing anyway. They pay you for doing things you don't want to do. Now, another experiment. This is 2009. This is about the power of money to affect people's sensory perceptions. Two groups of people put their hand into hot water, and they rated the pain from 0 to 10. Half of them, just before they put their hand into hot water, were counting banknotes. Half of them were counting pieces of paper. So how do you think that affected their understanding of the pain? Well, would you be surprised to hear? Think about Scrooge. Think about rich people counting their money, to hear that the group who counted the banknotes felt less pain than those who counted the paper. How can money act as a painkiller? Why did touching that money reduce people's subjective understanding of the pain? Well, even thinking about money makes people feel independent, strong, selfish, and valued. So, to summarize, money reduces people's desire for friendship. They did another version of the same experiment where they exposed people to a feeling of social isolation and discovered the effect was much stronger. For money is a painkiller when people were already sensitized to feeling social exclusion. So in other words, money substitutes for social connections. So it's not only your imagination that tells you that poor people are better people in the sense that they are more oriented to one another, because this is how they live. And this is how people generally do live, without money, which tells them something different from what their heart tells them. Money tells them the more money they've got, the easier life is. How do you get money? Off other people. So in that sense, it's a competitive thing. Now we're going to look at how money affects the language. Modern languages are full of revealing money metaphors. The first one, don't bank on it, means don't rely on it, as if banks are the most trustworthy places. What does it mean to say, I am broke? It means I don't have money. How does that equate to being broke? Well, all of this language strengthens the idea that money is strength, which, of course, is an agenda that certain people, viz. The rich, would like others to think. So that suits their view of the world, and being rich, they control the mass media, which, before the internet especially, gave them tremendous power over the language to which other people were exposed. What does it mean to talk about the cost of living? Well, it's like standard of living. It's very materialistic. but the cost of living sort of implies that life itself costs money. So then by implication, if you haven't got any money, well, what are you doing living? And this has the psychosis of money symbol next to it, meaning this is a reflection of our thinking. Language comes from people's thought patterns. So you hear somebody say you get what you pay for, then that sort of implies you only get what you pay for, and implies that money is a measure of quality. What does it mean to say every man has his price? Well, it suggests that people, like things, can be bought. How many times did you hear the phrase, time is money? It's funny how that one never seems to come up in Bangladesh, because people have been taught from a very early age that they are in a poor country, and yet everybody seems to have time, either for me as a foreigner or for one another. People are perpetually sitting around drinking tea, chatting. So they really do seem to have a lot more time than busy people in Europe, US and Korea, where everybody's got meetings to go to, things to do. But sort of equating time with money, I'm not proposing that humans need to change the time system. I'm suggesting the money system. So again, the two should not really be equated if we want to keep clear about what is possible. Maybe you know people who tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, this is the George Lakoff strict father idea. That's why you have to fight. That's why you have to be tough, because you're not going to get free lunches. Well, we know that hunter-gatherers think differently about things. And I do know people who live even in the developed country without touching money. Life is actually possible without money, although, of course, the rich would not like us to think that. Money relies on the logic of selfishness. Money is a way for you to get what you want. So if you accept the perpetual propaganda on commercial media that life is about money, then life becomes about getting what you want. This is the strict father idea again. He who pays the piper calls the tune. To the strict father, alienated work is needed. Why? Because there are disciplined people who prosper, end up rich, and indisciplined people who don't and end up poor. And for the natural order of things, along the survival of the fittest lines, the virtuous rich, the disciplined, the intelligent, the hardworking, should be in charge of the indisciplined poor, the great unwashed. So alienated work is necessary to amplify the intelligence and the industry of the virtuous rich. This slide I've called The Cult of Professionalism, and the quote is from L. Ron Hubbard, founder of that modern science fiction religion, Scientology, and he says, "So learn this as a first lesson about life. The only successful beings in any field, including living itself, are those who have a professional viewpoint and make themselves and are professionals." So, what does it mean to be a professional? Well, the root meaning, as far as I'm concerned, is working for money. But there are other meanings. The meaning of highly skillful, the meaning which is put forward by office professional. When that first came out, I remember laughing. It's like, well, what was the other version? Office amateur who runs an office for the love of it. But that was Microsoft's contribution to the language. Over time, professional has become a laudatory adjective. Now, if you want to champion something, how good it is, call it professional, and people assume that it's better than non-professional. Then, of course, there's people who behave professionally. You say she was very professional about it, then you can use this to explain somebody who disregarded their own personal beliefs in order to satisfy the customer. So you can see how those three different meanings, all coming from the same word professional, what are those three? working for money, putting customer wishes ahead of your personal beliefs, doing whatever you're paid to do, being alienated, and being highly skillful. Isn't it a confusing thing for those three all to be put under the same word, professional? So what's the take-home message here? Excellence, being highly skillful, means working for money, not love. Being able to alienate yourself from what you're doing. And when you ask, if you meet somebody, what do? You're usually not asking, what are you doing? If I say, what do? I'm asking, what do for money? How do you survive? But just limiting it, what do? People don't often say, I am a mother. I breathe. I listen to the radio. They don't say these things. They say whatever activity they use to gain money. So it validates people's activities and identities. Whatever they're doing, if they're being paid for it, it becomes a valid activity. Now, this slide is called glorification of hoarding. People talk about making money. It works in many languages. It works in German. It works in Bengali. It works in, I think, most modern languages. You talk about making with money, you're not talking necessarily about actually creating. You're not talking about engraving plates and stamping and making bills. You're talking about getting more money from other people than you're giving them out. Accumulating money is called making money. And because it's got the same word, then people associate making money, which is taking money off other people, in fact, with doing something like making chairs or making houses or making laptops, with real productive activity. So those who merely hoard money are esteemed as if they were creating real goods and contributing to commonwealth. And all of these misunderstandings, we've seen them reflected in the language, which is, as Lakoff says, intimately connected to people's decision-making and to the structure of their brains. All of these metaphors show the set of reactions which people have to money. I've called this slide Money as Status. There is one smiley on top of a hierarchy of frownies because the guy at the top is rich, which is associated with being good, in the sense of being good at what you do, in the sense of being morally good. You can be proud of being rich. So the rich are seen as hardworking, clever, productive, and according to the strict father model, why are you poor? Well, you're bad in a moral sense and in a sense of capabilities, so it's something to be ashamed of. The poor are lazy, stupid, and consumptive. So Africa, full of lazy, stupid, consumptive people. And if you look at the actual data about how little the poor consume and how much is consumed by the wealthy, it tells you a very different story. But the language is created as a veneer, as a way to deflect the truth from penetrating people's understanding. Recall Frederick Bastiat's assertion that the rich, the plunderers, create a legal system which permits what they do, and they create a moral code which glorifies it. So, is this inversion of reality associated with people's loss of meaning? And does this explain why, according to a WHO statistic, depression is the most common disability worldwide and still rising? I think it does. So what do we do about this? To conclude the chapter on personal corruption, how can we, who live more or less in touch with the modern world, try to escape the pernicious effects of this kind of twisted value system? Well, as much as you can, avoid making judgments based on money. Certainly avoid idolizing it and steer clear of any incitement to do so. So conspicuous consumption, lotteries, adverts in general, mass media, game shows, I mean, these are all very toxic things and we should not go near them as far as we possibly can. Now to move on, looking at social corruption. We've looked at how money affects individual psyches, but of course it takes all sorts of people to make a world, and some are more selfish than others, and yes, 1% of people are psychopaths, and other people may be psychotic or near psychotic if they are that focused on money. As an example of what I'm talking about, this is the psychosis of money, as quoted by David Corton, quote, "The minister responsible for Malaysia's forests explained that since money grows faster than trees, Malaysia will be better off once it has cut down all its trees and put the money in the bank to earn interest," unquote. If you are a lover of trees, you do not want to hear that your forest minister believes he should cut down all the trees. Now, I don't know the motives or the education of the chap concerned, but if you approach the decision as an economist, that might very well be the case. You're handing over control to the bankers, but I can certainly see how on a balance sheet that assertion might be unanswerable. The larger point is the corruption of thinking. Organizations that focus on money lose their own value systems. So as an example of this, you've got the strict father and his worship of market forces, the idea that the market is a replacement father in teaching virtue. Henry Ford said, "I am not in the business of making cars, I am in the business of making profit." And that's exemplified by the Ford Pinto, a model of car released in the 1970s. And one drawback of the Ford Pinto was that rear collisions of over 30 miles per hour had an unfortunate combination. Firstly, they jammed the passenger doors, and secondly, exploded the gas tank. So a lot of people were incinerated in accidents in Ford Pintos as a result. Now, Ford had already established this was a problem, but went ahead and released the car. And when asked to explain how they arrived at this decision, good economists that they were, they showed that they had applied a cost-benefit analysis. They had asked how cheaply this deficit could be remedied. Answer: a piece of rubber could be used to prevent the gas tank from igniting, which would cost about $6 per car, for every car they made, as opposed to how they expressed it as the cost of the death to them, which was about $200,000 in lawsuits from victims. And that's $200,000, but a relatively small number of victims compared to the number of cars. So it was more cost-effective to make defective cars. The two value systems were at odds. Are they trying to make the best cars? No, they're trying to make the most money. The next example by which systems are corrupted is that Ford were charged with reckless homicide, that they knowingly produced a dangerous product and didn't inform anybody about it, and the judge acquitted them. He didn't dispute the reckless homicide, but he said that Ford could not be convicted for doing what it was designed to do, making a profit. So not only was the car company corrupted by money in the sense that making good cars was not what they were about, they were making money, the legal system had a statute of reckless homicide to prevent homicides from occurring, but when push came to shove, and the interests of big business were at stake, then the judge caved. So, in fact, preventing crimes was not what it was about. As another example, in the Gospel of Matthew again, Jesus is reported as saying, "It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, the Roman Catholic Church, supposedly built on the teachings of Jesus Christ, by the 13th century, had an industry going. Popes were selling what they called indulgences, which I guess is a kind of a euphemism. It meant that for rich people who were busy making money, too busy, in fact, to bother praying for their own soul, for a price, then members of the Catholic Church would step in and pray for them. So the original message of Christ, that it's hard for the rich to get to heaven, was turned round 180 degrees. The school system, as we've looked at just recently, I had to try and summarise this in one slide, not to go into it in too much detail. President Woodrow Wilson is quoted as saying, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." Unquote. That was at the start of the 20th century, nearly 100 years ago, that he was reported as saying that, that what was called education was basically training people to do difficult tasks for money, not for love. If more people nowadays paid attention to such historical notes, then they could save themselves a lot of grief and a lot of misplaced effort trying to keep schools running. But no, it's too difficult for them to challenge what they think they know, what they think they've been taught. The next slide is called astroturfing. In case you don't know, astroturf is fake turf. You roll it out to measure, and in the same way, astroturfing by organizations is a fake grassroots. So the Save Our Species Alliance, SOSA, has a logo involving the USA and a fish and a couple of birds flying across it. And this is from their earlier website, now taken down. You can read about them on Wikipedia. It says, quote, "We are a nationwide grassroots organization comprised of property owners, farmers, ranchers, miners, foresters, builders, developers, sportsmen, recreationists, business owners, and ordinary citizens." No mention there of the timber industry. In fact, it was set up by the timber industry in an effort to oppose environmental protection laws. But they call themselves the Save Our Species Alliance. Now, how could you find that out? Well, if you followed the money, that's where does their funding come from, you would find this curt statement: "This corporation was incorporated in the state of Delaware. Names of the contributors under Delaware state law cannot be revealed to any other party." So, looks like a full stop if you're trying to follow the money. That, of course, is how money works. If somebody has money, you can't inquire about where their money came from. As an ordinary citizen, your choice is only whether or not to take their money and do their bidding. Now, those organizations with the most money will be those organizations which have concentrated on making money, and therefore those organizations which have given second priority, or which have completely ignored, their mandate, their stated mission. As another example of how the public discourse is corrupted, if you've ever used the term litter lout, then this, you need to know that this was invented by Keep America Beautiful, Incorporated. That sounds fine. That, in fact, was not a grassroots organization. That was the U.S. manufacturer's effort to promote disposable containers by blaming consumers for waste. So, diatribes against litter louts is blaming people for dropping litter. That, of course, got the organizations off the hook for making the litter. The larger model of regulatory capture should be well known to listeners of this show. The nurturing parent, of course, has an impulse to try to make sure everybody is cared for in society, and many government institutions, agencies, claim that they are serving the public. But as long as they are funded and they work by using money, then they are susceptible to control by those who can control the money. That is, many of them, at least, are controlled by big business. And if you're selling drugs and you stand to lose millions of pounds if a certain drug is ruled illegal, or if another drug is ruled legal, then a central point from which all these decisions emanate is a natural thing to want to control. having a hierarchy makes it much easier, public opinion on what is right and wrong, what is acceptable and not, very difficult to predict. Whereas a small centralized agency with rights to decide, much easier to control. The electromagnetic spectrum, radio waves, television waves, X-ray, ultraviolet and so on, very important for cell phones and potentially huge source of income using this, but limited in the sense that if you have too many electromagnetic signals, they'll interfere with each other. So originally these were managed for the public good, and there was a bunch of controls, and possibly even democratic controls. I'm not sure to what extent the public interest was actually manifested in their usage, but it's certainly not now, and there's no pretense at this, because the spectrum has been auctioned off. So the highest bidder basically got to use that. So effectively no difference between a company selling off its assets and getting as much as it can for it. So this market logic is applied to ever more of life. Now, this isn't as dramatic as cutting down a forest, but the abandoning of the ideas central to the nurturing parent, central to the caring society. If you have to put things on a left-right spectrum, which I usually don't, you would talk about right rather than left. The agenda of privatizing things, roads, railways, water, prisons, voting, even bioweapons research has partly been privatized. You might think that there were some limits to this. And if you check Adam Smith and other supposed apostles of the free market ideology, then yes, certain issues such as law and order and the enforcing of contracts were deemed to be the inalienable prerogative of non-market systems. However, that seems to have largely been forgotten about in the rush for profits. This slide is entitled Resource Capture. It's a picture of the Pentagon with a reminder that they lost $2.3 trillion as they announced on Monday, the September the 10th, 2001. That's 25% of all the money they ever received. How corrupt can you get? That's taken from a television report in which it said that the money was wasted, which sort of suggests it's like buying food and then it got spoilt, it never got eaten. But to think about wasting $2.3 trillion, I think it's a fair assumption that it got lost in the sense that it went into pockets other than those for which it had been allocated. Now look at Iraq, which for some years had more mercenaries than regular US soldiers, and they were officially beyond the reach of any law. Now I see a connection here between the strict father model, which says effectively that might is right, albeit measuring right in economic terms, well, it's not far to go from economic power to military force when mercenaries are up for sale. I see this as being linked to the increasing violence in failed states such as the US, which has a quarter of the world's prisoners and half of the world's weapon budget. The idea of government resting on a social contract, social consensus, something which is agreed, is being sidelined in favor of something which is enforced. This is the last slide in the corruption of society section. What couldn't we do about this? If more and more of the government bodies, of the agencies, if everything is being reduced to a struggle for money, and those who are corrupted, those organizations which abandon their other purposes and focus on money, if they are the ones which increasingly gain power, then I recommend that we avoid money as far as possible. Work with volunteers where you can, try and avoid any kind of bureaucracy, taxes, and regulations. Now, the last section, entitled Global Corruption, the most heavily armed and the most heavily funded organizations are the most psychopathic. And I don't think this is any kind of coincidence. Most national governments are actually almost irrelevant. You look at how easily they are changed and how easily they are manipulated by large, well-funded, psychopathic organizations such as the US military, such as intelligence agencies, and such as drug cartels, other organizations which are largely out of the public discourse. Refer to Peter Dale Scott to discover more of this kind of workings of really big money. So now let's look at the corruption of thinking, how the discourse of international organizations is off the mark. And this is a map of Africa from the World Bank, their development indicators in 2005. And we see that they're still defining poverty in terms of income. So the message then is that monetizing life will reduce poverty. If instead of babysitting the kids for the community for free, if you charge for it, then you're getting an income. So you're lifting yourself out of poverty. And of course, you know, where does that income come from? You've got to get it from other people. They've got to get it. So instead of doing things for you for free, they'll be charging. So if everybody starts charging, everybody's income rises. So according to their definition, then they are fighting poverty by making everybody enter the money system. And that, of course, suits the purposes of the rich who control the money system, who create money out of nothing, and who anyway have a lot more money available. So there may be many good people inside those organizations trying to do the right thing, and if they are fighting poverty as defined by money, then they are encouraging poor people to change their lives in such a way that they're more easily controlled by the rich. So looking at the corruption of the language as evidence of the corruption of thinking. How many times have you heard people say countries in the global south are poor countries to emphasize their difference of rich countries, not to look at the real world, not to look at how their societies differ, but as if money is what's making the difference. That's encouraging people from so-called rich countries to send money. Now, suspicion about the effect of sending money is one of the things that encouraged me to come to Bangladesh in the first place and really deserves its own entire show. So I'm not going to go into too much detail there. But now, another example of corruption of language, free trade agreements, or as Teresa Caraggio calls them, free to raid agreements, which I think is a little bit closer to the truth. Now, how free are they if the majority of people in that country don't support it and it has to be enforced? If it's agreed amongst a small paid-off elite who rule the country, if we call these countries economically underdeveloped, that's kind of presupposing that they need to be economically developed. And we've seen in earlier episodes of Unwelcome Guests what economic development means. It's a change of balance sheet, adding numbers, getting countries into debt. This accounts for economic development, not looking at the effects on people's lives. People may imagine an economically underdeveloped country is like an undernourished child, that it needs to have more development, the way that a child needs food to help it to develop. And this is really work for Lakoff, I suppose, to unmask some of these metaphors, some of these misleading parallels that people build in their minds and that weasel words are used to try to trick people into using. So look at the public mission of the World Bank. What do they say about themselves? Quote, "The World Bank is a vital source of financial and technical assistance to developing countries around the world. Our mission is to fight poverty with passion and professionalism, unquote. Now, we've had a look at what professionalism is and what sort of reality do you think is behind the financial and technical assistance to developing countries. Well, this is pointed to John Perkins on creation of the debt crisis without knowing that there was a deliberately engineered policy to get these, quote, underdeveloped nations, unquote, into unpayable debt. You can't understand the debt crisis, which is subterfuge to gain control over their economies and resources. Now, earlier I said that these large, well-funded, well-armed organizations are generally psychopathic in nature, and I couldn't find a better way to exemplify this than the infamous Summers memo. This is from Lawrence Summers, who in 1991 was chief economist of the World Bank, and he wrote an internal memo which was leaked, which contained the following quote: "I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted," unquote. When called to account for what he was talking about, countries in Africa are underpolluted, he pretended that the whole thing was some kind of elaborate joke. Now, I can find no more appropriate comment to make about such a statement than that which was made by José Lutzenberger, Brazil's Secretary of the Environment, who replied, quote, "Your reasoning is perfectly logical, but totally insane. Your thoughts provide a concrete example of the unbelievable alienation, reductionist thinking, social ruthlessness, and arrogant ignorance of many conventional economists concerning the nature of the world we live in," unquote. Now, Lawrence Summers was not sacked from his job as a result of that internal memo as chief economist, and he has since worked as Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, President of Harvard University, and since 2009, Director of the White House National Economic Council. José Lutzenberger, however, was pressured to quit the following month and never worked in politics again. So, to use a financial metaphor, he paid the price for speaking truth to power, while Lawrence Summers' career appeared to have been undamaged by such blatant disregard for human welfare. Now, this slide, the War on Terror, we've looked at many times, is basically using a phantom enemy to control citizens and boost profits for arms dealers and those who profit when people panic. Israel, of course, has a huge industry based on controlling terrorism, so people are encouraged to feel there's no alternative but paying more taxes to the government to protect them. False flag terrorism we've looked at on the show already in episode 533, how national security services stage a domestic attack as a pretext for a foreign war. If you pay for somebody to protect your house and your house is attacked, then you wouldn't perhaps hand over even more money to the same group of people to keep protecting your house. However, when it comes to the secret agencies, then there is no such discussion. The free market doesn't apply, and you are not within your rights to say, I don't want to pay my taxes to these people because I don't respect what they do, and you can't even find out how much of your tax money goes to fund a lot of this activity because it's off the books. It all adds up to an unaccountable superstructure which is above public scrutiny. We've looked at the Bilderberg meetings. We haven't looked at the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, Those three always seem to get mentioned together. The Bank for International Settlements, that is, the central banker's central bank. These are extremely powerful institutions, which are almost never looked at in commercial media. I mean, the names are not even mentioned. That is how low profile they are. And the World Trade Organization, to some extent, was put on the public map by demonstrations in Seattle. But the Bilderberg meetings still is unknown to many people. So what should we do about the fact that globally the most ruthless and violent organizations are prospering in the money system? My approach has been to seek people who work for love, not for money, to seek organizations which are non-hierarchical, because any kind of money-based hierarchy is subject to bribes, subject to financial coercions, to corruption, in a word. So free yourself from money psychosis as much as possible. Try not to think in money terms. Try and see the world as it actually is. One day it hit me how much tasty fruit I'd eaten, which had been grown in Bangladesh, and the fact that all I'd done was hand over bits of paper. I'd never actually planted any fruit. An imbalance, I thought, which I should try and correct. And that's what got me into permaculture gardening. Could you live without using money, or if the people close to you didn't use money? If the answer is no, then I suggest you take corrective action. And certainly it will correct your focus, and relationships will become much more important. I suggest it would be good preparation for the times ahead in which resource shortages undermine the existence of pounds and dollars and euros and the other centrally issued currencies, which tend to be administered by psychopaths whose greed, as we heard about last show, knows no limits. Now let's return to John Taylor Gatto.
Now think again about the meaning of the American lawsuits. Think of all the broken promises they represent, the cloud of bogus services misrendered for which redress is being offered. Is it just barely possible that the shift after World War II from manufacturing to what is now called a service economy is part of the reason for our visible unhappiness as a nation? Just as the earlier shift from an agricultural economy to a manufacturing one brought a sharp increase in general misery in its wake. Is it just barely possible that when most of us don't accept the obligation of free service to each other as part of the social contract, but instead assign the job to specialists and hired hands, that rather than the joy King Solomon promised us, the payoff is its opposite, grief? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do have an interesting bit of recent evidence in support of George Simmel's theory. In 1971, the United States National Book Award, which is quite a spectacular prize to win for nonfiction, went to a book called The Blood Relationship, a book which undertook to explore whether valuable things given to another free were more or less valuable than the same things given for money. The commodity the author took for his test of this proposition was human blood. He made an imaginative cross-national comparison of the quality and the availability of human blood in countries that charge for it, like our own, and in countries like England, where it is given away. Almost all blood in the United States is purchased wholesale and then resold several times for several profits. Almost all blood in England is donated freely and then it is given away for no charge. The book's conclusions aren't the slightest bit ambiguous. Everywhere on the planet where blood is sold, the quality of the blood is terrible. The prices are sky high. The shortages are common, and wherever blood is sold, there is also frequently great danger to the purchaser of the blood. I mean, it's a national scandal now in covering up how many people have gotten AIDS from blood transfusions. But there's an additional intangible cost of selling something like blood. Where blood is bought and sold, the community loses the tradition of giving freely to neighbors and to strangers. And where that tradition is lost, the donors of the blood lose the joy gained from service to the common good. In other words, a social and ethical corrosion ensues from the marketplace in blood. Communities that provide their own blood needs without cost are healthier for that. And in many ways, people seem happier in those communities. Transforming blood into a stuff of commerce is, one, inefficient in economic terms. Two, it's inefficient in supply terms. It's hard to get blood to meet the demand. Where it's given freely, there are seldom shortages of blood. And three, in quality terms, it doesn't add up. The social cost, in addition, is high. U.S. blood, the most heavily commercialized in the world, is also the worst blood supply in the world. The lesson suggested by my mother, by Biblical Solomon, by George Simmel, and by the blood experience, I mean to be a lesson for parents and schools too. When schools consume the youth of the nation in confinement, and all the products of all their labors dissolve into paper to be thrown away, there is no joy possible in seeking such a good. The pricing of time to a currency of grade points establishes an irrational medium by which something irretrievable and precious, time itself, is corrupted in service to arbitrary and meaningless urgencies. Experts who are the sellers of school services to government have consistently misdiagnosed and misdefined the problem of schooling. School problem is not the children don't learn to read, to write, and to do arithmetic well. Those deficiencies are directly byproducts of errors of our purpose. The larger problem is that kids hardly learn at all the way schools insist on teaching. Schools desperately need a vision of purpose because the vision they now angrily promulgate is a dishonest one. It was never factually true that young people learn to read or do arithmetic primarily by being taught those things. They are learned, but they are not really taught at all. So all the immense, intricate technology of school product is just so much hokum. Overteaching interferes with learning, although the few who survived the practice may well come to imagine that it was done by an act of teaching, through an act of teaching, that is, that they learned. Colonial America, it is easy to demonstrate, was massively literate without any systematic or compulsion schooling at all. For many decades, an artificially induced hysteria about basic skills has been the cover story behind which we were intimidated into abandoning children to a form of confinement schooling which simply doesn't work. Behind this mask, valuable lessons of service to a vibrant community of real human beings have been denied the young and denied all of us except for school teachers. All of us except for school teachers have been denied healthy interaction with children that adults need in order to remain fresh and vigorous. That's what Rousseau meant when he said you will never get control of the minds of children as long as they mix freely in the community. It's too exhilarating and productive for everyone they mix with. And I believe the same is true of old people as well. You need to confine these groups away in some form of isolation before you can properly treat the residue, the Middle Ages, the most productive workers, that you can properly treat them as instruments. to give and take, take and give. Children desperately need the lessons that volunteer service, apprenticeships, and work study teach. But instead they're kept in holding pens with others of their own age and social class. They are priced and valued according to their ability to adjust to this unhealthy regimen, to remain passive, to take orders, to maintain a cheerful demeanor while their time is being wasted. Children give nothing but are then rewarded for becoming quiet parasites. This has been, I think, the formula producing extended childishness in the outlines of a caste system in the United States, however well it has served the economic institution of mass schooling. After struggling at the bars of the cage for a few years, most kids just give up and settle into the low-grade activities of the school. The relentless rationalization of educational experience to one flavor, confinement schooling, has left the modern student a prisoner in a disenchanted world without meaning. Our cultural dilemma here in the United States has nothing to do with children who don't read very well. And I wrote this speech originally about a year before Hillary Clinton said this. Mrs. Clinton and I are certainly on opposite sides of many issues, but on this we're not. The real dilemma in the United States lies in the difficulty of finding a way to restore meaning and purpose to modern life. There is no point in reading if it seems to lead nowhere. We have progressively stripped children of the primary experience base they need to grow up sound and whole by pricing abstract study higher. The great irony has been that while we devalued service and life experience, abstraction has followed the path that George Simmel predicted it would by being priced. It too matters less and less. The dynamics of this process operate unseen. To begin with, the natural sequence of learning is destroyed without experience, a sequence in which primary data, hands-on experience, must always come first. Only after a long apprenticeship in rich and profound contact with the world, with the home, with the neighborhood and its people, does the thin gas of abstraction mean much to most people. After 26 years of classroom teaching, I slowly realized that what Benjamin Franklin, what he must have realized as a teenager, that only a few of us are fashioned in such a peculiar way that we thrive on an exclusive diet of blackboard work and workbook work and talkbook work. What we fail to take into account is that most children, rich or poor, really learn by involvement, by doing, by independent risk-taking, by shouldering real responsibility and not being parasites, by intermingling intimately in the real world of adults in all its manifestations. When we set up a laboratory universe in which our children are confined with anonymous strangers certified by the state, then we have created in advance a world of failing families, wrecked cities, and blasted individual lives. Then we have created the theater where a mathematical bell curve seems to describe the human condition in which few children have any real talent. This is a colossally cynical act. It is only prolonged in the face of its deadly effects because school factories and all the forces which service them have become an integral part of the money economy. The lie of our own unexamined premises has given us the horrible children we complain of as a nation. Indifferent children, cowardly children, dishonest children, selfish children, children who disrespect their parents and adults in general, who hurt each other, who trample each other's rights in exchange for worthless prizes like blue ribbons or school grades. Eventually, these are the children who grow up to be clients for the nation of lawyers I'll let you finish the rest of that sentence yourself. Children who will one day break contracts and encroach on the weak if an opportunity arises. And why not? For such is the example that 12 years of schooling has provided. Breaking of contracts, encroaching on the weak. The logic of confinement schooling in the middle of a democracy is a contradiction of our original national character. It breaks the contract of the Bill of Rights, using as its justification that kids can't learn any other way. They just can't be trusted with responsibility, and neither can their parents. And the truth is exactly the opposite of that. Unless they are trusted with responsibility, they cannot learn much, and under the thumb of central compulsion, the lessons they do learn are bad lessons. School encroaches on the right of each new life to test itself against the needs of the real world and to alter those needs by its own investment. Schools are a training ground for irresponsibility because irresponsibility is nearly the only thing they are set up to teach. Schools desperately, as I said, need a vision of their own purpose. At present, they are exactly what many suspect they are. They are government jobs for children, and the worst kind of government jobs, the make-work kind. They're not really jobs at all. There's nothing or very little to do in a school. Our elite high school techs are on the level of fifth-grade readers from 160 years ago. Instead of listening to Mr. Sizer or Mr. Gardner, the Carnegie Corporation, grab yourself a handful of school texts from the days when school wasn't compulsory and look exactly at what's been done to us. It has not happened by accident. And dumbing down the work isn't merely some sinister conspiracy, although certainly it is that, too. It has become more and more a necessity as generations of well-schooled children reproduce themselves, become parents, and have nothing to communicate to their own children. So the damage is cumulative, and it is fast becoming insupportable. Look around you at our society. We've created a whirlpool of addiction, and when I use the word addiction, I never think of drug addiction. Addiction's much more unmanageable than drug addiction. Addictions which children and grown children use to avoid confronting themselves with their own uselessness. We are reluctant to face this narcotic reality of our common society because it acts as a criticism revealing much more than we care to face about the real source of our difficulties. We have forced children to become irresponsible for all their natural youth. It is no wonder they hate themselves and hate us. No wonder they cannot recover. If you cut a man's legs off when he is a boy, they will not grow back when he is a man. With the growing public alarm over the effects of science and technology on societies all over the world, we are soon going to have a chance to rethink the basic questions of education. Questions which have very little to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic, but much more to do with the fundamental questions of human existence. In what curriculum shall a good life be found? How should we all live? What shall we do with our children? My own suspicion is that systematic government compulsion schooling is doomed. Whether meetings like this occur or not, that it's doomed. There's no way to tinker with this thing to make it work much better than it does already. And soon the monopoly is going to have to be surrendered because it hurts people too much and it is far too expensive. If well-schooled children are the goal, they can be turned out at a fraction of the cost of government-schooled children. John Chubbs of the Brookings Institute responded to charges that breaking the government monopoly would hurt poor children and children of color by producing figures that showed private and parochial schools are far better integrated than the public schools are at about half the cost. But frankly, I don't think the world can afford well-schooled children at all anymore, whether they come from the factories of government, of church, or of private industry. We need a different kind of man and woman to tackle the future, the kind of young people who accept the obligations of living joyfully and with responsibility. To get to this new place, we need a vision of what an education is and what a school should be. Only out of a clearly spoken vision can come the mutual hope we need to find ways to get there. Curriculum is only the Latin word for a race course, the path by which a horse gets to its destination. We have not even begun to agree as a nation on a destination for education that is worthwhile. Beating other countries, scoring well on tests, getting a good job, all these are low evasions of what the human spirit really needs. All are ways to duck the truth that we have failed thus far to pay the price in argument and debate, in agony and in love, that a strong vision would cost us. Without a vision, all the talk about reforming curriculum leads nowhere. Unless we can convince ourselves, our children included, that the new course is worth following, it will not work any better than the old course did. And why should it? A political state, by its very nature, provides a vision that misfits human nature. States are exercises in power and coercion, not exercises in wisdom. If we learn to read better and were given time to reflect in our youth, I think we would all realize this. A vision, certainly the people who founded this country and gave us the Bill of Rights understood that clearly, that the state was no guarantee of your rights, but just the reverse. That's why schools aren't mentioned at all in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution. Not a word, not a hint of it. They understood what it was. A kind of colonization of the human mind. A vision has to be a destiny far beyond winning, beyond money, beyond, as the gentleman said yesterday, schools should be about, good health and money. For the question always reemerges, good health to what end? Money to what end? Why are we doing these things? Messy and as unpleasant as it will be for a practical people like Americans are, the sequence has to start with clear goals. In a and if the town can't provide you clear goals, or the state can't provide you clear goals, or the nation can't, then you've got to provide them for yourself. In a democracy worthy of the name, goals come from the bottom up, not the other way around. It will be messy if it's done right, because hundreds and thousands of separate agendas will be set in conflict by any attempt to change what is. And we will learn finally that we need multiple visions, many different curricula. There is no one right way. If I guess right, we don't have a choice. The present race is almost over. The whole food supply is in jeopardy, for one thing. Breeding stocks of fish along the California coast are at the lowest levels in history. Cape Cod Bay, where once fish were thick enough to walk across, is a dead sea in many places. The radical conclusion forces itself upon us that our oceans are dying. In Kansas, one bushel of irreplaceable topsoil blows away for every bushel of corn raised by factory farming methods, and that is true in all wheat and corn-growing states. The food value of chemical agriculture's harvest is already much lower than the natural harvests of old-fashioned farming. If my guess is right, we need to construct a new vision of what education is, and we need new race courses on which to run that vision. The government can't do it for us. That's been tried for 140 years in monopoly schools, and they just got worse and worse. And the more tax money you surrendered, the worse the schools got. The two lines follow each other neatly on a graph. And they are correlated. If it could be fixed, it would have been fixed by now. There is no correlation between the play money of grades and the play money we buy things with, except the dishonest correlation that's forced on the job market by rigging it with arbitrary licensing laws and arbitrary hiring policies. For example, you can establish by law that the only people who can get into medical school are the people with lofty grade point averages, but that does not guarantee that the best people become doctors. The same unpleasant reality holds for lawyers or businessmen, engineers or school teachers. We have yet another warning that forcing the collective time of the American young into a contest for symbols, whether money symbols or grade symbols or similar prizes, is a mistaken course. And that warning is found again in the Proverbs of Solomon, in the haunting predictions of George Simmel, in the frightening reality of the American blood supply, and in the curious emergence of a national horde of lawyers who demonstrate our unhappiness. We do not trust each other. We do not like each other. We do not care for each other. We are unable to keep ourselves from encroaching on each other, and we cannot keep our promises. That is a recipe for social disaster. The new vision of American education is going to have to find a currency beyond money with which to pay its children to learn. My own experience after 15 years of sponsoring volunteer projects for each one of my students, rich and poor, white and black, is that a curriculum that seeks the common good will be an important part of that real currency. Not all of it, but an important part of it. And a currency that doesn't inflate as grades do, one that holds its value. My own experience has been that every single academic question worth asking in any of the disciplines can be asked around a base of genuine service to genuine communities and can ride easily around an orbit of service. My own kids always did one full day of community service a week. They generally worked all alone in order to escape the culture of school children. They took on full-out responsibilities because I wouldn't allow the transaction to happen any other way. The community service program in District 4 that's been nationally trumpeted over this country as one of Ted Sizer's prized displays is an absolute fraud. It's 2 hours a week, and then they spend 2 days talking about the wonderful things they did. My kids took on full adult responsibilities and they had a full adult work day even at the age of 12 or 13. And in almost every case, they discharged their duties splendidly. Even in the first year I experimented illegally with such a program, because I didn't bother to tell the school I was doing it, it worked. Indeed, it worked better for the selfish, spoiled, indifferent children of prosperous families than it did for the lost children of the poor and the non-college bound. But I'll tell you that it worked for both. The differences were small. It worked for everyone, including the communities which allowed themselves to be served. It transformed children spiritually, morally, and academically. In Western society over the past several thousand years, we've had at various times great social visions such as the one that I'm urging us to find now, or the many that I'm urging us to find now. We had the pagan vision of Stoics like Marcus Aurelius. We had the aristocratic vision of Charlemagne and the Plantagenet kings. We had the Christian vision of Saint Augustine, of Origen, and of the martyrs. And all these grand conceptions for which curricula were developed had a service ideal at the bedrock of their foundations. Although many of the details of these competing life curricula contradicted each other, at the base of all three was a service ideal, a sense that we were obligated to each other inextricably, that we needed to self-impose duty if we expect to live easily with others, not to have multicultural classrooms where you're told to love your neighbor, and the direct result of being told to love your neighbor is for you to despise your neighbor. That is the great secret we have lost sight of in schools built around a philosophy or a theology of materialism, a curriculum of competition and accumulation, a curriculum of self-aggrandizement, that these directives are prescriptions for bad individuals, bad communities, bad societies, and bad consciences. All the transforming visions we have human record of anywhere in the world ask a question beyond money. They ask, what do I owe, and how do I pay that debt? And in the answer to that question, I think the secret of our future lies. And these visions promise that if we will speak for those who cannot speak for themselves, if we will be generous to the poor, if we will seek the common good, that our lives will be filled with meaning. It worked for Solomon. It worked for my mother. It will work for the rest of us, too. Thank you very much.
I hope you found this show rewarding and that it'll help you reflect on what kind of changes are really needed in the time ahead. I'm aware that I've spoken for longer on it than any of the other shows, so for that reason alone, I'd particularly value any thoughts you have. Send them either to me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net or to the mailing list, which you can contact via altruists.org/unwelcome. All previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Does the U.S. support an apartheid state in Israel? Dr. Virginia Tilley. As this program goes out to broadcast in early April 2018, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have embarked on what they call the Great March of Return. In their thousands, they walk to the electric fence that has kept 2 million Gaza residents penned in for more than a decade. They plan to sit in a tent city until Nakba Day on May 15. That day marks the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, or catastrophe, when the marchers, their parents, or their grandparents were forced to flee their homes upon the creation of the State of Israel. Israeli soldiers killed 17 Palestinians and wounded more than 1,500 others in the first few days of the Great March of Return. Analysts on U.S. media, such as Democracy Now!, as well as noted Israeli journalists, call Israel an apartheid state. The same analysis had been made just a month earlier by Dr. Virginia Tilley. She spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., at the annual conference organized by the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. The theme of the conference was the Israel lobby and American policy. Speakers such as human rights attorney Noura Erekat, Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, and many others explored the different ways in which a powerful lobby for Israel, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, steers the flow of donations, foreign aid, and weapons to Israel. They also warned that the Israel lobby might succeed again in causing the U.S. to launch a war against Israel's perceived enemies in the Middle East. Janet McMahon is managing editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. She introduced Dr. Virginia Tilley.
As a result of last century's two world wars, the majority of the world's countries committed themselves to the principle of international law, which was embodied in the United Nations. But adherence to that principle and to the institution has not been guaranteed, and in some cases has been outright undermined. Our first speaker, Dr. Virginia Tilley, is a professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel-Palestine, post-apartheid South Africa, and Oceania. She is the author of The One-State Solution, a pragmatic analysis of the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Despite intense pressure from Israel and the U.S., the commission's chair, Reem Khalif, refused to withdraw the report and resigned in protest. The UN subsequently deleted the report from its website. Fortunately, however, we are about to benefit from the expertise which informed that report's findings. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Virginia Tilley.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be here, especially in the somewhat daunting position of first speaker. I have to set the tone. In this presentation, I'm not actually going to talk too much about the findings of the report. I'm going to briefly summarize the report itself and then talk about what I think is much more engaging at this point to me, which is the implications of the report, implications for diplomacy and conflict resolution in Israel-Palestine. So I was asked to address the question of, is the U.S. supporting an apartheid state in Israel-Palestine? Well, yes, it is, in short. It is an apartheid state. And by the way, there is no such thing in international law as apartheid state, but its practices are consistent with apartheid, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the deeper answer here is yes, and so are a lot of other people, including people who wouldn't think they are. And that's what I wanted to come to in regard to the implications of this finding for questions such as the two-state solution. Essentially, those seeking partition are endorsing an apartheid state, and that is a bit startling, so I want to get to that. And it raises this dilemma that if apartheid anywhere is inadmissible and destabilizing, it cannot comprise the basis for a just and stable peace. Now, this lifts us out of a question of whether you're pro-anybody, And simply, if you're concerned about international peace and security, which apartheid is considered to be a threat to. So in this talk, again, I'm going to talk briefly about the analysis, the legal definition of apartheid, how it works, and why it requires Israel to sustain the occupation. This is a particular point I'd like to bring forth here, and then move on to the implications, and why it brings us directly to the question of reunification as the only viable mode of conflict resolution. So it is based on three sources. The first is my own book that I wrote narrowly on the question of whether Israel could be expected to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a two-state solution. The second one was this really extraordinary experience of coordinating a team of international lawyers. I'm a political scientist, not an international lawyer, through a project supported by the South African government. It is a legal analysis. And the third one, of course, is this wonderful experience I had, a privilege of working with Dr. Richard Falk on the UN report, which was mentioned already. And a lot of what I'm going to say here came out of that report, but a lot of what's in that report relied on the previous one, Beyond Occupation. So the deeper legal analysis for the UN report is to be found there. So what is apartheid? We use apartheid very broadly. Anything that sort of strikes us as racist or segregationist maybe elicit this term. But if we're going to argue that states are accountable under international law to act to end apartheid, then we must refer to the law which prescribes that obligation. That means we are brought to the relevant international law, and that is found in two major instruments, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The first definition is far larger, much more detailed, but it lists a series of acts, including segregation and reserves that I'll come to. But it says that these are only acts of apartheid under certain conditions. They have to fit certain overarching conditions. And those conditions include, they may be similar to practices in South Africa. This is a universal instrument. They do not have to be exactly the same. The point is whether they have these other qualities of the law. These are acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination. I call that the purpose clause. And that involves racial groups and a systematic system of oppression. It is not just a random collection of discrete laws, but a comprehensive institutionalized system that distinguishes the apartheid, and the Rome Statute picks up on that by bringing in a new term, which is institutionalized regime. Political scientists get all flushed with pleasure when you talk about regimes because we have loads of theory about regimes. We start to feel a little bit more on familiar land. All these elements of the definition are satisfied in this case. The report, I refer you to the report on this. It is an institutionalized regime. It's a comprehensive system of laws that ensures Jewish national privileges. And I want to stress that hyphenated construction here, the idea that Jews are a nation and that as a people or a nation that they have this certain privileges, that it does include policies similar to South Africa, but any policy variation there would not disqualify them necessarily, but it's nonetheless quite suggestive that they do. It is a racial conflict according to international law, defining what is racial discrimination, which includes groups defined by descent. And in this case, the local construction of Jewishness and Palestinianness or Arabness is descent groups. The key quality here which conveys special privileges to one group over another is postulations about their descent and therefore their rights to the land dating from antiquity, expressed particularly in the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, which has the status of constitutional law and Israeli law. I'm speaking kind of fast here about law, so if you're getting a little like the wind outside, it's not to worry. It's clarified in the report. And crucially, the purpose clause is satisfied that there is this aim, this formal aim, to maintain Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We have a cluster of laws and policies on the books to look at to confirm that Israel has that purpose, in, if anyone was in doubt about it. So from a legal perspective, that is satisfied as well. What was more interesting to me when figuring out how Israel was pursuing its apartheid regime was the way it works, which is these crucial policy variations among four interwoven domains. Domain referring here to a territorial, a geographic entity, and a cluster of expectations, norms, rules, practices within that geographically defined ambit. The first domain being Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, what matters here most is the right to vote, because if you're going to have a Jewish and democratic state, then it is, becomes important not to allow non-Jews to vote those laws out. That means that you have to constrain the vote. You can allow people to vote, but you can't allow them to vote on that point. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that the non-Jewish vote is never large enough to threaten those laws. So Palestinian citizens of Israel famously do have the vote, which is often cited as the crucial difference with South Africa, but they are not allowed to vote against their own minority status. They are not allowed to vote against the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, about 300,000 people, have no national vote. They can vote for the municipal government, but not for the national government, so they are carefully excised from that potential body of voters who could challenge the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinians in the occupied territories, of course, have no vote. They are not citizens. And they can vote for the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but they are carefully sequestered. 5+ million people are carefully pushed out of any possibility of joining an electoral bloc that could challenge this state. And Domain 4 is the Palestinian refugees outside of the territory under Israeli control, which is clearly, obviously, they don't have the vote. So another way to think of this is as a system. One regime that is effectively composed of four tailored sets of laws covering each population to achieve the same goal, which is to ensure that Israel remains a Jewish and democratic state. All kinds of arguments about whether you can be a Jewish and democratic state or a white and democratic state, I recognize that, but we don't have time to get into that now. What I would like to stress here is that this system requires that Israel maintain the occupation. Because if Israel does not keep the occupied territories under belligerent occupation, under military occupation, it faces the twin threat that a truly sovereign Palestinian state could form in those territories, which would then threaten Israel's capacity to prevent population mixing. Population mixing is the death knell for any racial state because the neat division of populations begins to go away. When you have people mixing, they make babies and it all falls down. On the other hand, annexation or full integration would require providing citizenship to the Palestinians, so that cannot be allowed either. Current talk about annexation is reflecting that dilemma, but it's better for Israel not to annex it. So what is the solution? Well, military occupation. So people say, well, we have to solve, we must put apartheid to one side in order to look at the occupation. I think you have that the other way around. One is the logic of occupation is following the logic of apartheid. So speeding right along, part two, implications for diplomacy. If apartheid, as it always does, it destabilizes the whole region, threatens international peace and security, it must be stopped on those grounds alone. It is morally untenable. It's a crime against humanity. It must be stopped. But how? The vision of two states is fatally flawed. My first book on the one-state solution got into this in some detail. Just from a pragmatic point of view, I really only addressed that one thing. And what it does mean that we cannot anticipate that Israel will withdraw. It's become emperor's new clothes kind of fantasy to think that that will happen. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. It requires a great deal of defense, and it fails. sustaining Jewish statehood on the part of the territory, this is the crucial thing. If you partition the land in order to allow Israel to remain Israel in one part of it and a Palestinian state to form in the other part of it, you are basically saying apartheid will continue in that part where Israel is now composed. Saying Israel will continue to be a Jewish and democratic state, will continue to operate the way it is operating, will continue to be apartheid regime in a slightly different, modified border, within different borders. Now, my thought experiment, to transplant that I did in South Africa, it would have been okay for white South Africans to sustain apartheid in part of the country and turn over the rest of it to black South Africans. No one entertained such an idea. It was anathema. This is the same thing here. You can't end apartheid by dividing the land and allowing it to continue in another part of the land. There's other aspects of this, but cutting to the chase, I would propose, therefore, that reunification is the only way to end apartheid. And since there's so many reasons to do that, we have to take that very seriously. For activism, and by activism I mean every kind of activism from grassroots to legal activism and diplomatic activity and so forth. And I just wanted to focus again on this angle of end the occupation. End the occupation is a mantra. It's a slogan. It's a sign people carry in marches. It's also a legal argument. But how? Again, Israel's withdrawal from the OPT cannot be anticipated. At best, it would be very partial. This is the Olmert plan, where all the yellow would be Israel and the white would be Palestine, with a little umbilicus between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is obviously an unviable state building. You couldn't control water. You couldn't control agriculture. You can't build a road that connects them. You can't, it's unworkable. Would not end apartheid. Establish a state of Palestine to leverage withdrawal. Now, this is a very popular movement right now, big diplomatic push in the United Nations to do this. However, my point here is that if we accept the apartheid analysis that this is an apartheid regime, then such a state would be a Bantustan. It would lack the attributions of true sovereignty. Israel, as long as it is composed as an apartheid regime, cannot accept any Palestinian state that is not a Bantustan. Because any truly sovereign state would threaten the Jewish national character of Israel. This means that a Bantustan state, a state of Palestine formed under these conditions, would only secure Palestinian poverty, underdevelopment, frustration, insecurity, and essentially sustain the conflict itself. I'd like to just take an extra moment here, and I'm going to destroy my time constraint, I hope not. That a little bit of extra attention to the Bantustans is worthwhile, and I frankly encourage everyone here to Google that and spend 15 minutes looking at the Bantustans a bit more than we sometimes do. I went to South Africa to study this material because I realized I didn't understand it, and I found it fascinating as a comparison to the Palestinian Authority and the territorial and institutional constraints that it's operating under. Let's just think through the logic. Apartheid imperative, the imperative of apartheid, wherever it would appear, would be to prevent racial mixing. Okay. Otherwise, the whole logic begins to fall apart. If you can't discreetly have different populations, there's nothing to defend. In order to do that, you need strict geographic segregation. This requires that if you're going to actually make this work, you need separate authorities within these territories. The South Africans, interestingly, called them black self-government authorities. And guess what Oslo called them? Palestinian self-government authority. It's a great deal of conversations between Israel and South Africa about the Bantustans. It took a lot of lessons from it. I learned that from the diplomats in South Africa, by the way. This channels Palestinian or black or indigenous political aspirations to the local authority rather than to the state, to the dominant state. It's very convenient for an apartheid state to displace the frustrations and ambitions and the quest for rights of the population it's dominating to their own leadership operating under very tight constraints, of course. The pictures you're looking at on the top is a lineup of the Bantustan leaders in South Africa in the Bantustans, but nine of these leaders were in this picture, and are below the Palestinian Authority. And by the way, I don't mean to impugn the integrity or political will of any of the Palestinian Authority people. My point here is a structural one, that they are put into a position where they are compelled to act like a Bantustan Authority. From the point of view of the dominant state, the main function of this authority is to repress dissent, which in the top picture you see the Bantustan armed forces, and in the lower part you see the Palestinian armed forces doing exactly that, maintaining the Bantustan through proxy measures. The Oslo Accords, we don't have time to get into this. I wrote a separate article about this, though, because I found it fascinating. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority on terms almost identical to the South African Bantustan constitutions, blow by blow. If you put those next to each other, you find almost exactly the same arrangements. And it's interesting that the ANC perceived this as a trap, rejected it from the beginning, and refused to have anything to do with it. And in fact, I understand Nelson Mandela told Arafat, bad idea, don't go for this. This is not a good idea. And they went for it anyway. So in short, the PIA is now locked into being this self-government authority, and it cannot act independently of that role. The alternative, therefore, is if the partition can only sustain apartheid, and we must rethink the conflict on using South Africa not as a model but as inspiration or a thought experiment. They called it colonialism of a special type. It doesn't involve agreeing and admitting that a large population of people has come in and indigenized, is settled, is not going to go away. Call it settler colonialism, shift the model from a colonial to a settler colonial model. And that means that you can't end settler colonialism and its power by partition. You have to end it by eliminating settler domination. Treating Palestine as a multinational state on the basis of race would only perpetuate a settler discourse, because it is Zionism that has proposed that there are these identities that if you recognize them and institutionalize them, you're essentially perpetuating apartheid. Treat the whole country as one country, Palestine, wrongly divided by race. This was the South Africa formula. It's one country wrongly divided by race. This means reunifying Mandate Palestine. There is a legal basis for doing this. If we turn back to the League of Nations Mandate, it always proposed that it was one country for everyone who lived there, that it would not be a Jewish state or anybody's state. It would be a secular democratic state. So there's a nice, fat, legal argument to explore there. The hard part of this is that reunification does raise very serious questions of identity shifts to reconstruct the idea of the nation, reconstruct the idea of the groups. In this case, Palestine would stop being a foggy mandate reference or a dreamy future, but it would be one state that belongs to all who live in it. It would not be the exclusive geographic heritage of any one part of the population. It would not require the departure or exclusion of anybody, which is tough for people who have lost a great deal to it. Jewish has to be reconceived as an ethnic group with full civil, social, and cultural rights, not a people with superior rights to the land, not as a nation with rights to self-determination. And Palestinian, this is the toughest thing for me to say as a non-Palestinian, but it returning to the idea that it is a multi-sectarian identity, it still is, actually, embracing everyone in Mandate territory, not Arab in any sense that would exclude non-Arabs. Okay, this is one of the problems that Palestinian became Palestinian-Arab state. And under conditions of settler colonialism, you can't do that without excluding non-Arabs, and therefore, unfortunately, that has to be rethought deeply. Not the racial ethnic construction affirmed by Zionism and imposed by apartheid. So that's why the apartheid finding recasts everything. That's why so many people don't want to tackle it. I think it is crucial. I think it illuminates where we are and what is going on. And the more I look at it, the more powerful an analysis I think it is. And I do hope you will consider it seriously as a model for rethinking the conflict. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Virginia Tilley. She's professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel, Palestine, and post-apartheid South Africa. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report for the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices to the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. She spoke on March 2, 2018 at a conference on the Israel Lobby and American Policy organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear from human rights attorney and activist Noura Erekat. She's an assistant professor at George Mason University. Before that, she served as legal counsel for a congressional subcommittee in the House of Representatives and as the national grassroots organizer and legal advocate at the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Videos and transcripts of the conference can be found via the website of IRMAP, that's short for Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and Phil Conlon is here. And how are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Going to talk to Rick Sterling, a member of the Syria Solidarity Network, who is someone who has been following the events in Syria for many, many years and writing very ably about the matter. We want to talk, of course, about the alleged chemical attack and its possible sources. And we will talk to Stephen Gowans in the second half, who also has been writing on the same matter. We think the issue deserves as much attention as we can bring to it because the propaganda around this matter is very heavy. And we want to announce some events. Phil, there's one in...
Three weeks from today, on April the 30th, you can go to Hamilton... and that is the hcsw.ca is your website, and you can hear the Reverend Naeem Atik talk about a theological discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
It's liberation theology. He's a Palestinian minister of the...
He's in the Anglican Church of Canada, yeah.
Right, and it's the New Vision United Church, 7 p.m., and in light of what's going on in the world, it would be a good idea to go to that meeting. And let us tell you, there's a demonstration at this moment. In a half hour, I estimate, at Bloor and University, where there is a I just got this as I came in the door, so I can't tell you who's sponsoring it, but I know I support them. They are demonstrating in condemnation of the Israeli use of lethal force against unarmed demonstrators.
Yeah, I think Independent Jewish Voices is one of the sponsors.
Jewish Voices.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I think we are joined by Rick Sterling. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am, Phil.
Hey, Rick, thank you for joining us. This is a fast-developing story with a lot of dangerous elements to it. When we originally contacted you to talk, of course, we intended to focus primarily on the matter of the allegation about use of chemical weapons in Douma. But, of course, in the 24 hours since, we've learned that somebody has and there's been an aerial attack on Syria. So I want to get your thoughts on that. But I guess we should start with this matter of the what appeared to me to be the last moments of a rather desperate group of terrorists. I don't know their label. I'll leave that to you. But the Syrian army is prevailing, has been. Mm-hmm. And there is actually quite dramatic footage coming from Vanessa Bealey showing the people who've been held as hostages for many years being rescued from that very zone, I guess, of combat. And yet, and then all of a sudden, we hear that there's been a chemical attack and the president is considering doing something about it.
Right.
What do you make of that, of the allegation and why it comes up now, and what do you think about it?
Well, actually, I was looking back in my my notes, and almost 1 month ago, the Russian news agency TASS had a story titled U.S. Planning Missile and Bombing Raid Against Damascus. And that would be after a provocation. The U.S. plans to use Syria's government plans to accuse Syria's government forces of using chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And so the chief of Russia's general staff, Valery Gerasimov, said this a month ago. He predicted that the one of the armed factions would, in collusion with their supporters in the West, would fake a chemical weapons incident, and that would be used to justify a U.S. attack. And it looks like that's where we're headed. Now, in that same TASS story from March 13, the general says that in the event of a threat to our military servicemen's lives, Russia's armed forces will take retaliatory measures to target both the missiles and their delivery vehicles. So this is, we're entering very dangerous
territory. You could put that in italics, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. So it's very dangerous. The big picture is that for 7 years, the West, the NATO forces, primarily along with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies and Israel, have been pouring billions of dollars a year, financing a mercenary army of over 100,000, trying to overthrow the Syrian government, and the project is failing. The Syrian government for years now has steadily been recapturing control of all the most populated areas, Homs, Aleppo, and now this this area on the outskirts of Damascus called the Eastern Ghouta. And it seems that what's going on here is that the forces of reaction, the hawks, and those who basically advocate for Israeli and Saudi interests are doubling down. They're going all in to stop the Syrian government from prevailing in the conflict, and they're again using this pretext. Hello?
CIUT 89.5, Toronto. Hello, this is the Tater Report. Mysterious things. I wish I could explain it, but Mama didn't send me to any technical schools, so I'll just have to make do. We're going to get back in touch, we assume, with Rick Sterling, and we hope you're all well. I'll remind you. Maybe I'll say, I don't know, it was this announcement. There's a demonstration at a university in Bloor condemning the action of the Israelis in targeting people. And we're going to do our best to get Rick Sterling back. And then we'll continue on. We'll get to Gallons. We have a lot of more adventures than I had anticipated. I'm going to say, Phil, we lost a good friend, Tom Power, and we're going to later on in the show we're going to actually do a little some music in connection with him. But he's a memory we want people to appreciate. He was one who stood up.
A very strong supporter of the station and of this program, the Taylor Report, of my program, Classical Underground. He was like a real stalwart.
And yes.
It was always wonderful to know you had this loyal audience out there.
and he was we live in a hemisphere, and he appreciated the other nations that are they used to call them the South, and who they don't get respect in this culture, the Northern culture. He was a great admirer of the Cubans in particular for standing up to the power, which every Canadian is aware of, and.
You mean the power that Canada doesn't stand up to?
Yeah, the one that Justin Trudeau is a little bit shy about mentioning. I think we are. Do we have Rick Sterling? Rick, are you there? I'm sorry. We had a little technical glitch. We don't blame it on you. You are saying important things. You were summing up. You were saying that there is some desperation here on the part of three big players: Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Papa player, that would be the U.S., because they are experiencing setbacks, all of them, right? I mean, Saudi Arabia's big campaign in Yemen has it's underpublicized, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Right, right. And Saudi Arabia's the big funder of the armed faction that controls or controlled up until recently Douma, that town where the chemical weapon incident happened on Saturday. So Jaish al-Islam, or the Army of Islam, is the terrorist group that's controlled that town. It's basically completely funded by Saudi Arabia. So they're a big player in this, as Qatar is. Israel has been kind of operating behind the scenes. They've provided medical assistance and other kinds of help to terror factions in the Golan region, and they've actually attacked the Syrian forces at various times in support of the terror factions. Mm-hmm. And then the neoconservatives in Washington, the foreign policy hawks, they still believe that this is the new American century, and they're not willing to let it go.
That is probably, at least from my vantage point, the most disturbing element. You have two parties, but they both they are war parties, right? And when Trump said, and we all thought he was probably pulling our leg, that he'd like to get out of Syria, Bernie Sanders said, oh, no, you can't leave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I don't envy you being in the Bay Area, because I don't hear voices. I can remember back at the time of the Vietnam War, there were several prominent – there were senators, there were congressmen who – was their piece of the political scene, was that they said, no, I don't agree at all with this. But I don't hear any opposition in your country.
The left in North America and the West, it's not just the U.S., has been demobilized by disinformation on Syria. They failed to stop or denounce or criticize the Western overthrow of the Libyan government. I mean, there were, 15 years ago, there was a lot of opposition to the invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. Anybody with eyes to see knew that George Bush was planning that war, and it was a charade they went through beforehand. So there were massive demonstrations against the invasion, you know, for the year preceding the invasion in 2003. But the Libya attack and now the ongoing war against Syria has been done with massive confusion on in the progressive community. So they basically a lot of the disinformation that used to be done by the CIA is now done by what they call civil society groups. Even rescue groups like the White Helmets serve the role to basically broadcast the propaganda and misinform the public.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that image, because the White Helmets in this instance and previous is the kind of go-to source, and they always describe them as rescuers. However, right. I've never heard of a rescue organization in war theaters that called on foreign powers to step in and use power to intervene in their situation. Usually rescuers are just worried about saving lives getting support.
Yeah. Well, they're primarily a media and a public relations organization. They have a very effective social media campaign. Their marketing is managed by a group in Brooklyn, New York. And that's part of the problem here. So they have been successful at demonizing the Syrian leader, the Assad, and the Syrian government, so that a lot of people just assume these things are true, that the Syrian government targets hospitals, that they routinely torture people, that they attack civilians. But all the evidence, you know, from the ground, from people who have been there, who have seen them in operation, actually contradicts that.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Rick Sterling, Syria Solidarity Network. You don't find Rick's writings, just put in Rick Sterling. He's many articles analyzing this situation. On this matter of chemicals, isn't Syria the one player in the area that has actually been engaged with international agencies and said we had chemical weapons, we no longer have? There was even, and there's this body that on the prohibition of use of chemical weapons inspected. Wasn't there an agreement that it had been accomplished, that they didn't
that's
have
right.
them?
Yeah,
whereas
that's
other
right.
players, I want to ask you about this too. The Israel has chemical weapons, we understand. The United States certainly does. And isn't it also true that some of those groups in Ghouta them have used chemical weapons and I think in one instance maybe admitted that they did?
Right. Yes, as the Syrian government advanced in eastern Ghouta and basically came to agreements with the different terrorist groups to vacate, to evacuate, they uncovered a chemical weapons lab with chemical weapon ingredients that could have been used. There's also a chlorine gas canister. It looks to be a military canister that was discovered. And if we go back to 2013, actually what the conclusion there, the investigation of Seymour Hersh and a number of others, was that attack in eastern Ghouta in August of 2013 was carried out by one of the armed factions with the sarin provided by Turkey. And two Turkish parliamentarians actually held a press conference with documentation confirming that. So there was a lot of evidence then. And since then, the accusations go back and forth. But the accusations by the West that the Syrian government is using chemical weapons, when it comes down to it, it's always the White Helmets or some other Western-funded group that's making the accusations, or it's people who may have been coached, people in southern Turkey, or people from rebel opposition-held territories who are making the accusations. And there's little or no concrete evidence. Now, the mm-hmm. situation right now is that Douma is on the verge of being totally recaptured by the Syrian government. There was an agreement yesterday. Busloads of militants or terrorists, you know, use your own terminology,
terrorists.
And their families are being yeah. evacuated from the area. Tens of thousands of civilians are moving into the government-held territory since the militants aren't preventing them from leaving anymore. So there's the opportunity, if it's true, if the claims are true, well, the White Helmets should provide the detailed information where this happened and have a serious investigation.
Yeah.
Somehow I suspect this is not going to happen.
No, by the way, as you tell that, one realizes it's to a large extent, as you indicated, it's somewhat propaganda and theater. If you did have a proper investigation, one of the things that anybody looking into it would say, and you say you are the White Helmets, what do you do again? And could we look at your work? Because if you're going to claim you know something,
right.
You know, you got to put yourself in the witness box and show how you know that.
Yes. Yes.
They never go into an environment where anybody can interrogate them.
Right.
They just make bald claims.
Right. And actually, as the civilians have escaped from the terrorist-held zones of East Ghouta, they're being assisted by a Syrian Arab Red Crescent. They're being assisted by rescue workers who are legitimate rescue workers, and there's no sight of the White Helmets. We only see them in the videos, which are used to sensationalize the situation and try to get the West to intervene militarily. That's the main area where.
Yeah, and they're not shy about that, are they? I mean, they've called a number of times for the U.S. particular to do something.
Right, right. Yeah, no, exactly. They, they've done that explicitly, and so has the Syrian American Medical Society, which predates the conflict. I think it was a legitimate organization prior to the conflict, but since then their budget skyrocketed. I took a look at their tax returns at one time, and their tax returns skyrocketed. It's pretty evident they're, or it's very likely they're getting heavy funding from the U.S. Government, and yeah. they are another—
Which increases their credibility in
yeah,
the way the
well,
U.S. operates.
Yeah, they're another propaganda organization. That's the role they play. They have no role. They do nothing to help civilians in other parts of Syria that aren't controlled by Al-Qaeda or one of the other Wahhabi Takfiri organizations.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking to Rick Sterling and Syria Solidarity Network. Rick, I remember a year ago, and it was almost a year ago, that when Trump first decided he was going to strike Syria, and there was a report that in northwest Syria, I think it was, that there had been chemical agents
right.
alleged. And Trump said, our prime minister here said, oh, well, that should be investigated,
right.
and the perpetrator should be punished.
Right.
And he said that like on a Tuesday. On Wednesday, he said, I fully support the actions mm-hmm. of the U.S.
yeah.
Now, this is, and you pointed out, we have nuclear armed, very powerful states bumping into each other here.
Mm-hmm.
What,
mm-hmm.
The two are represented always as equally involved, that is, the United States, Russia, but there's a rather serious difference
mm-hmm.
in that description.
Yeah.
Could you explain, are they on equal standing in terms of
well,
their role
no.
in Syria?
No, absolutely not. It's pretty clear if we look at international law and we look at the finding of the International Court of Justice going back to when the U.S. funded the Contras trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government that Ronald Reagan did not like. That cost enormous bloodshed and the U.S., which basically created the Contras, provided them with money, with arms, with training, with logistics, their actions were found to be in violation of international law. And they were actually ordered to pay compensation in Nicaragua, which, of course, they did not do. But what we've got going on in Syria is quite comparable. And the former foreign minister of Nicaragua, Father Miguel Descoto, he confirmed that that opinion to me. He said, yes, what the U.S. is doing, the U.S. and their allies are doing in Syria, is tantamount to the supreme crime of creating war and all of the crimes that flow from that. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. Is there illegally. They have no authorization from the Syrian government. What the U.S. has been primarily done is in cahoots with Canada and the U.K. and France and the Gulf monarchies and Israel and Turkey. They've been funding a proxy army seeking to overthrow the government. In contrast, Russia came in at the request of its ally Syria and has been supporting the Syrian government, but they're not on equal footing legally by any stretch of the imagination. What the U.S. is doing is an international crime. So that makes it all the more ironic when we hear the cries of war crimes by Assad, who is actually the Syrian government is, you know, on the basis of my visits there, my two trips there and the research I've done and the, all the contacts I have with Syrians and so forth, Assad is quite popular. He's more popular than the Ba'ath Party. Mm-hmm. And if you watch interviews with him and see him in operation and see the principles he stands for, you can kind of see why. He's a relatively young man. He's very intelligent. He is an ophthalmologist. He was trained as a medical doctor and then an eye specialist. And although he came into the position, you know, through his father's history with the Ba'ath Party, he's basically stood strong in this assault on his country, and he's stood for the principles of secularism, of equality between men and women, of respect for, among all religions. And these are important things in Syria, and it's ironic that Canada, the U.S., and the West has been supporting the most reactionary sectarian groups that will impose all sorts of inequality on women, that all sorts of inequalities between religions, and that is really an extremely violent organization. Mm-hmm. So this is the irony that we have here now, where black is white and white is black, and, yes, and it really requires people to follow and read widely, read a lot beyond the mainstream media to understand what's going on. And you actually have to know, you have to be aware that some of our alternative media has not seen through the lies either. So you really, one has to be careful.
By the way, just on that last point, many in the United States certainly seem now to have imbibed that powerful drink of American exceptionalism.
Right.
We're the arbiter.
Yeah.
They seem to really like that great declaration that there's going to be a new world order and we're number one.
Yeah. It's horrible. I don't know if it's something in the water here or in the U.S. or what it is, but yeah. But, you know, I grew up in Canada myself, so I am aware of a lot of the common areas, but aware of some of the differences. And I would say that's one of the differences, that Canadians don't have quite the same extent. They didn't in my generation of we are entitled to rule the world, which – sadly, that seems to be heavily promoted. The wording they use now here is leadership, global leadership, and the neoconservatives and the foreign policy establishment here are basically aware that the U.S. is losing credibility, power, and power around the world, and they want to regain that. And the sad situation is that they're disasters, the invasion of Iraq, the overthrow of the government of Libya, what they're doing to Syria, the threats against Venezuela, the threats left and right. It's just it's kind of escalating the decline of American standing around the world.
Yes. They've decided to double down, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
Rick, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We apologize for the break in the earlier part of the show. You, as always, it's very enlightening. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you, Phil. Take care.
Bye-bye. It's Rick Sterling, and this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. That's the sound of my phone. I'll get that in a moment. This is, I think we have a little bit of John Lennon, and we will come back with Stephen Gowans.